That's right.
Good morning, everyone. This is the Senate Interim Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. It is Monday, September 15th, and we have a full agenda, so I'd like to move it along. And I'd like to open an informational meeting on the update from Cover Oregon. And I'm going to have Tina Edlin come first. She has a conference call that she needs to go to immediately after her presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tina Edlin. I'm the IT Transition Project Director with the Office of the Governor. So I am here today to, are the slides going to be projected? Sorry about that. It's just, will it? Okay. I think I need to get to the slideshow, though.
Oh, I don't know.
I guess I'll have to do it this way.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Now we can get started. So I'm here just to update you on the progress of the transition project. If you remember, the board for Cover Oregon.
Did she introduce herself?
Yes, she did.
Okay, yeah, I did. Sorry. Yeah. The board for Cover Oregon made a decision in late April to transfer its technology or transfer the technology functions to the federal government for commercial enrollment in healthcare and tax credits and back to the Oregon Health Authority for Medicaid eligibility. I was asked to step in from the governor's office to direct the project and to ensure that on November 15th, Oregonians could enroll in healthcare in a more simple and a straightforward process. So the project goal for the transition is just about that. It's just about the eligibility determination, the IT piece of that. We have two goals. There's two separate projects. It's the Medicaid side and the commercial side, the private coverage side. So Oregonians eligible for commercial coverage and tax credit should be able to apply, shop, have their tax credit determined, have their cost-sharing responsibility determined online at healthcare.gov, which is the federal website. Oregonians eligible for Medicaid will have a more streamlined process than they currently do. That was the transition project goal. So to accomplish that goal, as I said, on the commercial side, we'll use the federal technology. It's to transfer the qualified health plans over to the federal exchange, to be seen on the federal exchange. I think it's really important for people to remember that that piece is not a technology project. This is really just more business processes. This is our role with the QHPs is really to ensure that they have a smooth handoff to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to get listed on the federal exchange so that people, Oregonians, can shop for coverage and see their products. On the OHA side, moving the eligibility rules engine over to OHA, the original project plan has actually been altered somewhat. We've implemented a mitigation strategy that I'll talk about just very briefly. The goal, though, is that people, Medicaid clients, will have an opportunity to choose the best door for them. They can choose either to go to OHA, complete a fillable PDF form and submit it, or they can choose to go to healthcare.gov, the federal website, have their eligibility determined and then sent to us to be enrolled in a coordinated care organization. So the actual update is the development for the new application, the landing page. It's not a website. It's just a landing page where people can get screened really primarily for Medicaid. The URL will be OregonHealthcare.gov. They can go and get screened and determined and best determine the door for them. to apply for Medicaid. The transition of commercial enrollment, and I will talk about this a little bit, is the original plan is on schedule. The deliverables are being met. It's going as planned. And then the transition for Medicaid application and eligibility, we actually have a mitigation in place and an improved plan from the original. As I said, on the commercial side, moving to healthcare.gov, there's no technology development with that. It's really to update business processes so that we can smoothly go to the federal website. And our role is to work with those plans. The qualified health plans now work directly with CMS in order to have their plans uploaded onto the federal website. The one other thing I would say, I think the important piece here is really coordination between the state and the feds and the health plans. We have, in fact, we've established a communications subcommittee. We meet with the plans every week, and we've established a communications subcommittee so that we make sure that we're coordinating what's being sent out to who at what time to try to really minimize any communication confusion. And this is just, I don't expect anybody to actually be able to read this on the screen or on their handout even. This is just to show you there are lots of ways that we track this project. We produce at the project level one of these documents every week for the Medicaid side and for the QHP side. This allows us to track the deliverables. We can see what each one of those diamonds represents the deliverables. On this side, it represents what our role is, what the CMS role is, and what the Office of the Insurance Division's role is. As you can see for this project, everything is on, all the deliverables have been met, and the timeline is being kept. I think that you'll notice there, if you can actually see it, you'll notice that the only thing that's in yellow is budget, and that was because at the time, this was from September 5th. At that time, we had not had our budget rescoping, is what the federal government calls it. It hadn't been yet approved, but it's been approved as of last Thursday or Friday. So that can move to green now. The current project status for the QHP transition is, you might remember, there are 15 plans that participate in the Oregon marketplace. Of those 15 plans, 10 are fully uploaded to the federal website. Actually, now it's 12. Two more came on at the end of last week. Three are in process, and we're working with them to make sure that that goes smoothly and that there are no hang-ups there. I think it's important, you know, we have one less plan participating in the exchange this year, but in fact we have one less carrier, but we have more plans than we had in the previous year. We had 102 medical plans last year, 140 for 2015 benefit year. So this is to show you, this is the same kind of a chart we use to follow progress for on the Medicaid side, and this is where we have had to implement some mitigations to the original plan. You'll see that and these are all posted on our website. We really have tried very hard to make sure that literally every piece of paper gets posted on that website so that everybody can follow along the different ways that we track this. The items to the right of the bar, the vertical bar, you'll see a text box there that explains that since we are rebasing that project because we have implemented an adjustment, those dates will change going forward. So the project status on the OHP side is that we have stopped development on anything that's dependent on Oracle. We had asked Oracle for some additional services they declined to provide. That meant we needed to move the movement off of Oracle servers a little sooner than we had originally planned, or move the Oracle servers to the state data center sooner than we had originally planned, which meant that we're actually delaying some implementation of automation at the state level till later in the year. it was going to happen earlier. What we did to adjust for that was we talked to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services about using healthcare.gov for Medicaid clients where it made sense for them to do that. Any Medicaid client who's eligible for Medicaid on the basis of income probably is going to have a better experience at healthcare.gov. But the intent of our new landing page, the OregonHealthcare.gov, is to help them go through some questions and determine which is the best place for them, and they'll have a choice. We think this will actually relieve some current workload. There's about 25,000 new applications. We estimate there'll be about 25,000 new applications a month coming through OHA that could potentially go to go to healthcare.gov, go to the federal website. We anticipate that some of the renewals that actually take a full application can also go there and not require the manual process. This isn't a forever kind of an arrangement. However, the federal government has only given us permission to use healthcare.gov for Medicaid clients through August of next year. It's a 1 year. It's not a waiver, but permission.
And then what will they do?
Well, so the project plan, as you see, this updated project plan, by August of next year, we will have our self-service portal up. We have an obligation under federal law and under the ACA to have a Medicaid self-service portal for people to apply, and that's the piece that needed to be delayed because we're moving the servers earlier than we planned, so we're delaying some of the original project implementation until later. So in the meantime, we'll use healthcare.gov.
And have we contracted with someone to create a portal, or is that in existence?
That is the work, Senator, members of the committee. That's the contract that we currently have with Deloitte to actually implement this transfer of the Medicaid system over to OHA. That contract, what we're doing is we're changing the scope of work in that contract. So some things that they were going to do now, they're going to do later. We're moving those off into the future. So it's in the same contract.
And do you have a contract with them where they have deliverables and timelines? And
yeah, their contract is a fixed price deliverable based contract. We are renegotiating the scope of there are unique scopes of work within that contract. What we're doing, since there are deliverables that they don't now in phase one, they aren't going to be delivering because we've changed the scope of the project. We will change that first scope of work to reflect that there are fewer deliverables. They will be paid less for that. The dollars that were assigned in that front end will be spent later in the second phase now with them. So,
finish you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tina, in the last hearing on this topic, or mm-hmm. at least one of the last ones, I talked about the importance of having a plan B mm-hmm. in case on November 15th mm-hmm. The federal site doesn't work like we anticipate. Do we have a plan B?
So the plan B has always been that we would use the process we currently are using, which is the hybrid process. It's how we've gotten over 400,000 people enrolled in healthcare over this last year. I think that is the plan B. Again, having this full automated experience is really the what we all want to achieve. But healthcare.gov is working. It's working right now. It's working for 34 states. There's no reason to anticipate that it would quit working, but you're right. We need to make sure that we have that mitigation in place. We have also mitigation plans that Deloitte has been working on for us, not only this mitigation that we're implementing in Medicaid, but mitigation plans for what do you do if the servers just go down temporarily, what's the mitigation? I mean, we have that happen here, you know, all the time where we get the message. It's what's the mitigation for that? And so they're working all of that, and those plans are due to us toward the end of September for those individual mitigations.
Fellow? So the plan B is to use the hybrid process. Are we going to have hundreds of people hired and ready to go at that point on November 15th? Should healthcare.gov network, or are we going to have to spend a month or two hiring people, ramping back up?
So we've been looking at that process really carefully and applying, you know, lean techniques to it where we can really get the process down to the minimum number of workers that we need. Right now, I think, and I hope I'm not misstating here, my understanding is that it's about 75 temporary workers left on the OHA side. And again, I'll check that number and make sure that's right. They anticipate, the people who run that process anticipate with the systems they have in place that they can handle a temporary situation where they would have to go to Plan B.
Can I just clarify something? Thank you, Madam Chair. So you're saying these 75 people will be shifted over to cover Oregon in case on November 15th, or they would be responsible for handling people on the private side.
Senator Shields, they actually work. It's the same people who process applications now. When an application comes in, we can't tell whether it's for private coverage or for Medicaid right now. So it's the same group of people who process all of those. So it's not a matter of shifting over to cover Oregon. It's just that we would continue the process we currently use.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Okay, so the last slide, this just shows the updated project plan. The last slide is really to show, you know, part of the reason that we were able to adjust fairly quickly is that we have been in mitigation planning from the very beginning. One of the things we learned from the first time around with this project was that we needed to make sure that there were Plan Bs in place and there were mitigations for individual possibilities. We also wanted to make sure that everybody felt fully informed and fully aware, and that there are multiple touch points is really what I want to say here. I meet three times a week with CMS on the phone, so we have CMS's eyes on this all the way along. It is on the Medicaid side. They pay for 90% of the costs, so obviously they're very interested. I meet regularly with LFO and the state CIO. I meet monthly. I meet weekly with the governor to update him. I think there are lots of points of accountability. I think that has proved to be really important to us that we have been able to respond really quite quickly and keep people informed. My steering committee for this project is actually made up of the five agency heads that are touched by this project, and they meet with me actually every week as well. So with that, the last slide here is really the web page. All of our progress reports, all of our external, the external vendors, the Maximus quality assurance reports, their quality control reports, they are all posted out here. We post as fast as we can get them up. It's really, like I said, it's an opportunity for everybody to be able to follow the project and see how it's going. This is a long URL. Actually, if you just go to coveroregon.com, there is on their front page is the transition project, and you can click on that and get to all of this data. So with that.
Thank you, Tina. Any other questions before we call Aaron Patnoide? All right. Thank you very much, Tina, and you are excused.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Aaron Patnoide, Executive Director, new Executive Director of Cover Oregon.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. For the record, my name is Aaron Patnoide. I am Executive Director of Cover Oregon. And again, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. So what I will be presenting this morning is an update on Cover Oregon activities. Some of the information that Tina just presented does pertain to what I'll be talking about. So the first slide just covers what we'll cover today. So I'd like to provide an update on 2014 enrollment, progress and challenges that we've been experiencing, and also an update on the advanced premium tax credit that I've discussed with some of you over the phone and in person over the past several weeks. For 2015, I'd like to talk a little bit about the supported state-based marketplace model, revenue implications, and also budget planning for 2015. So I'll jump right into 2014. So on slide four, what you'll see here is an update, excuse me, as of September 8th in terms of enrollments. The top box is specific to Cover Oregon enrollment. So those individuals that have come through Cover Oregon, whether they be commercial or Medicaid eligible. So total medical enrollments through Cover Oregon are at 353,454. Over 101,000 of those enrollments represent commercial enrollments, and the balance are OHP enrollments. We do have 20,000 members who have also enrolled in dental plans. The Oregon Health Authority has also used a fast-track process to enroll 138,955 enrollees, which puts our total medical enrollments, combining those numbers together, at 492,409. So this is a great update. It's good information, and folks in the state are getting the coverage that they need through commercial and Medicaid programs.
And how do we rate amongst other states, or will you get to that?
Chair, members of the committee, the response to that and the answer is we're about middle of the pack when compared to all the other states in the country.
Thank you.
Perfect, Madam Chair. Because most of those are the Medicaid expansion, how do we rate as far as, I mean, have we reached that number yet that we projected? I think we've got to be pretty close, aren't we? And how do we rate as far as, against other states, as far as the expanded enrollment option?
Chair, members of the committee, I don't have that exact information right now, but that's something I'd be happy to bring back to the committee. The next slide, slide five, demonstrates our net enrollments and effectuations as of September 8th. So net QHP enrollments were at 78,616, and net QHP lives effectuated, 67,479, which represents an effectuation rate of 86%.
And what do you mean by effectuation?
Chair, members of the committee, effectuation rate is the number of people who have actually paid their first month's premium for their insurance policy.
Follow-up, if I may, Madam Chair. So just to clarify, Mr. Patton, do you have a sense of why it is that there's a 11,000-person discrepancy? Is that a normal lag, or is that people who've been enrolled since last December and haven't paid yet?
Chair, members of the committee, that's exactly the answer. Is there, you know, from an individual's perspective, for one reason or another, they will make a determination whether or not they're able to pay their first month's premium. So what we work on with our carrier partners is making sure that we can have properly effectuated individuals and families enrolled in plans, but it is dependent on the individuals or those families making the payment for their premium.
Follow-up, if I may, Madam Chair. Thank you. Again, to sort of echo Senator Mona Sanderson's question, how does that compare percentage-wise to other states? And do we have a sense, it's a two-part question, I apologize, but do we have a sense of whether those 11,000 people are confused about how to make it happen, really can't afford it, are uncertain about the subsidy? Do we have a sense of why that is and the percentage compared to other states?
Sure. Chair, members of the committee, We don't have an understanding of why there is that gap there. However, what we'd like to do moving forward is work to increase our effectuation rate. With an upcoming open enrollment period, we have the opportunity to do that. An industry standard for effectuation rate is between 80 and 90% when you look at the commercial insurance companies. So in terms of how we compare to the industry in general, we're right in the middle of the road. However, I do think there is opportunity to increase the number of people that are effectuating on their policy.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, Madam Chair, kind of a response to Senator Steiner Hayward. Anecdotally, I think some people assume they wouldn't have to pay anything, and so there's an education process in here as well.
True. But yeah, that's about 85%, just doing some rough arithmetic in my head. So.
All right, next slide is progress and challenges. So in terms of agent commissions, this was an area that we were working to improve our performance upon. Happy to report that we are 95% paid on deposits, or 95% of deposits have been reconciled. Actually, $1.03 million was disbursed in August, which was the largest disbursement amount to agents and brokers for doing work for 2014 plans. Our goal remains to pay on 100% of the work that the brokers and agents have done for the marketplace in the state for 2014. In terms of QHP life change requests, these are when members call in and have a birth in the family or a marriage, divorce, et cetera, and need to change their coverage. We have processed 13,079 requests since June 20th, and as of September 11th, we have 821 requests left to complete, and we also receive about 150 new requests per day. So we get in new requests, we have to process. So eventually our goal is to become current with that, and we continue to work with that goal. Case corrections, these are errors in applications, data errors that we also have to process. So we've processed 4,161 corrections since June 20th, and as of September 11th, we have 880 still in the queue to process. Again, our goal is to become current on those. So the next slide is relating to the advanced premium tax credit update.
And that has to be done by hand, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
And
it's
that
a manual
should go
process.
Away once we get a up and running IT system?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. So one of the benefits of using healthcare.gov is that it's a proven tested technology that's been in place for a year. And the eligibility and enrollment work will move from being a state responsibility to the responsibility of the federal government, and I'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay. But it's still going to have to be data entry to do it, so.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. So Cover Oregon will still be responsible for processing 2014 information. All 2015 enrollment will be done through healthcare. So regarding the advanced premium tax credit, I'd like to reference this handout that you all should have in front of you. So as many of you know, we identified an error in how we were applying advanced premium tax credit to individuals that purchased 2014 coverage. So the document that you have in front of you represents an update on where we stand with that correction process. So there is text at the top, but I'd like to move to the middle part under example of the problem, because I think this will help folks understand a little more clearly what the actual error is.
Now, this is covering what's been in the media regarding people who may have to pay money back, and there's been a whole hubbub.
That's correct. All right. So for a couple making $30,000 a year, their maximum contribution to pay for health insurance was to be $150 a month, just given where they sit in relation to the federal poverty level. The benchmark plan that they could purchase, that was 100% essential health benefits, the base level of coverage that's mandated by the federal government, was to cost $620.55. When you subtract off the $150 maximum that the consumer would need to pay to get that plan, the maximum advanced premium tax credit would be at $470.55. So a plan selected with 99.5% of the, that's comprised 99.5% of the essential health benefits would cost about $465. And therefore, since $465 is less than $470.55, the total amount of that APTC should be credited, and the actual amount covered by the APTC, the 99.5%, would be $462.72. And I know this is a little confusing, but I'll get into it in the next image down. So the way that Cover Oregon was incorrectly applying the advanced premium tax credit was actually to the entire value of the premium for the consumer. So in this particular example, if a plan was 100% advanced premium tax credit and the person was entitled to $465 of advanced premium tax credit, we would apply the full $465. However, on the right, in the green bar, you can see how advanced premium tax credit should properly be applied to the example that I gave in the that I gave earlier. So if a plan is comprised 99.5% of the 10 essential health benefits package and contains 0.5% of non-essential health benefits, the APTC should only be applied to that portion of the premium that represents the essential health benefits package. In this case, it would be $462.82, leaving $2.28 that the consumer would need to cover for those benefits beyond the essential health benefits package. Cover Oregon historically had been applying the advanced premium tax credit to the entire package, when we only should have been applying it to $462.82 in this example, meaning that we erred on $2.28 in this example. So we overpaid the consumer $2.28. So that's an example of the error. I have an update on where we are in terms of our analysis of the error on the next page.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Patton, I will freely admit that I didn't understand that the tax credit only applied to the essential health benefits. Mm-hmm. And when we launched Cover Oregon last fall, I spent some time acting like a consumer, even though I get my insurance through PEB, and went on and compared a bunch of plans and everything and played with having a bunch of different incomes, including my legislator income, which puts me well below the federal poverty limit for a family of four, which I am. And I didn't, it was not clear to me anywhere that it would only apply, I don't remember it being clear to me anywhere, that it would only apply to the essential health benefits. Was that not made clear to people? Was it made clear to people, but Cover Oregon still miscalculated it? Could you help us with that piece of it, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's very confusing work. And we are not the only state that has made this error. Washington State also made this error with the functioning technology. They actually had identified this problem early on and in after open enrollment period and were able to adjust it for consumers before they actually had to start paying on their premium. So it's very confusing. We're not the only state to have made this error, but I think just given the complexity of the Affordable Care Act and the essential health benefits, it's difficult for anyone to really understand how the advanced premium tax credit should be applied. Luckily, with the partnership of the federal government, CMS, SIO, the IRS, we're ensuring that the application of the APTC is corrected to be applied to consumers moving forward.
And if I may, Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
Does that mean that when consumers go onto our website to compare plans, they'll be able to tell what percentage of that plan qualifies as essential health benefits and what percentage does not?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't have the answer to that since we'll be using healthcare.gov for 2015 enrollment, but that's something I can easily find and report back to the committee on.
Because I think that's pretty important for consumers as they make the choice, if they have to understand what the difference, because they're still going to have to pay that difference. Mm-hmm. They will still be paying that amount in premium, because it's not as if the insurance company won't get the premium, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Cruz?
There's something on your first page that I find counterintuitive, and that is the premium for at 100% of essential health benefit is $6,2015, and at 99.5%, it's $465. That seems like one hell of a drop for 0.5%.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the $462.82 represents 99.5% of the maximum advanced premium tax credit amount that's available to the consumer.
Okay. Now, do we, when, if I could, Madam Chair, when do we've had two different court opinions on that issue. Do we have any sense, because if you read in the Affordable Care Act, I think 10 different places, it basically says that only applies to states with their own exchange. But we've had court opinions on both sides of that issue. Do we have any idea when we're going to see any certainty on that issue?
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't have an answer to when we'll have the conflicting decisions from the D.C. District Court and the Virginia District Court. What I do know is that as it applies to the state of Oregon, for 2014, we're a state-based marketplace, so there's no impact to the advanced premium tax credits that are available. For 2015, we will be a supported state-based marketplace, which means that there will be no impact to the advanced premium tax credit of those decisions. The decisions directly impact the federally facilitated marketplace states, which are 27 states, wholly federally facilitated marketplaces, and the 7 that are partnership marketplaces, so 34 states total. Oregon is not included in that group.
But at this point in time, the Supreme Court has not put this on their docket, have they?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, not that I'm aware of.
Because that's where it'll have to be decided. So, okay.
So I'd like to jump into the analysis of the problem, because this will show how many people and how many families are actually impacted by this error that Cover Oregon has made. And it's important information to report on. So the 42,367 tax-paying households we identified as the potential total universe of families impacted. It's on the handout. Yeah. It's on the second page of the handout.
It's not up there.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. The reason it's not included in the presentation is that this is the most up-to-date information. We wanted to make sure we were reporting accurate information. So 42,367 tax-paying households we identified as the potential total universe of families impacted by this error. And again, that represents the universe of potential errors. So out of 39,000 individual and family records we reviewed, that's 92% of the total, we have identified 775 errors. That's less than 2% of that 92% that we've analyzed. The remaining 8% that still are being analyzed right now represents more complicated cases. Perhaps they decided to change their plan over the course of the year, which just means a little more time that we need to analyze those to make sure that we properly calculate the error, evaluate the error for those 8%. So the financial impact to those 775 taxpaying households, 62% had errors that represent less than $2 difference per month. 27% had errors of $2 to $12 per month, 6% had errors of $12 to $100 per month, and 4% had errors over $100 per month. Our initial concern was that this could potentially impact a large population. However, given the analysis that we've conducted, we're finding out that it's a relatively small population that we've impacted with this error, and we'll be reaching out to those individuals to discuss the correction.
Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you. So the reporter from the Oregonian, Nick Budnick, who I have a lot of respect for, said he had information indicating that there were 10,000 people. You're saying that. Can you help me understand where he might have gotten that information?
Chair, members of the committee, I can't speak for Mr. Budnick where he received his data from. What I can speak to is that we've done a comprehensive analysis of 100% of the individuals that were available for or eligible for advanced premium tax credit. We have touched all of those cases, and these are our findings at this point in time.
Okay. Madam Chair, so I just did a little scribbling of what we're looking at, assuming your numbers are correct. We're looking at somewhere between $171,000 and maybe $300,000 total.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, if you look at the mean value of impact, so the average value of impact to the families that are impacted by this, it ends up being about $9,600 per month. So multiply that, you know, times an average of, say, 10 months out of the year, and we're looking, you know, somewhere in the $100,000 range. However, upon completing the full analysis, so of that remaining 8%, we'll be providing the exact dollar impact once we're aware of that. So right now its estimation is we still have that 8% outstanding.
If that's the case, I mean, it seems to me that it would make sense that we as a legislature and as the executive branch should figure out a way to make these people whole rather than making them pay for our mistake. Do you have any comment on that?
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Cover Oregon will be working with members of the legislature to determine the best route for the consumers that are impacted by this. So we'll continue to have those conversations, and we'll seek your support in doing so.
And final follow-up. So they would need to be made whole by April 15th?
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. So it's very important to acknowledge that when consumers applied for coverage for 2014, when they entered their income, it was a projected income. So there was going to have to be some reconciliation done at tax time in any event. We do process income changes that cover Oregon on a regular basis. It's part of those qualifying life event changes. So we have a process in place to adjust incomes. We will work with the 775, and if that number should increase when we get through the remaining 8%, we will continue to work with those consumers to determine if an income adjustment would be appropriate so that it lessens the likelihood they would have to pay in to the federal government come April 15th.
And then if I can make one final comment. One of my concerns is that there have been numerous times along the way when we've received testimony from Cover Oregon where we've gotten an indication that the problem's not really as bad as it appears, mm-hmm. right? So I think that to the degree that we can get a second set of eyes on those numbers mm-hmm. to take a fine-tooth comb to them, I think mm-hmm. we'd feel much more comfortable heading towards April 15th if we had the worst-case scenario and maybe had a second set of eyes take a look at it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So I just want to talk briefly about next steps, and I realize that I'm running long here, but I'd also like to talk about revenue on budget. So next steps, so we will, Cover Oregon will contact all consumers impacted by this tax credit error. The amount of the tax credit given to the affected households will be adjusted to the correct amount. We're required to do that by the federal government. And the customers can choose to further reduce the amount of tax credit being applied to their monthly premium in order to reduce the chance of having a tax liability. So. As I mentioned earlier, we do income adjustments as we go through the process anyway, so having the opportunity to do that could lessen the likelihood that a consumer would have to pay into the federal government. All right, so 2015. So just a quick reminder, the 2015 open enrollment period goes from November 15th of 2014 through February 15th of 2015. So it's upcoming. It's our primary focus right now is Cover Oregon, ensuring that Oregonians have the opportunity to go and shop for plans that they're entitled to under the law. So it's very important that we have this focus. So the goal for November 15th is to allow Oregonians the opportunity to apply, shop, and choose a private plan all online, all in one sitting. As Tina mentioned during her presentation, Medicaid eligible will have a more streamlined process and also ensure that Oregon retains control of the individual and small group marketplaces. I think Tina did a good job of highlighting the level of competition that will be in place in the commercial market for 2015. The rate review process as conducted by DCBS and the OID is proving to work, and we've seen some variability in the rates compared to 2014. And as Tina stated during her report, there are actually more plans available for sale in the 2015 commercial market than there were last year. So the carrier interest in the market still exists. Oops. So the supported state-based marketplace. So as Tina and Clyde Hamstreet reported during the May legislative days, the federal government has acknowledged a transitional state of marketplace for Oregon, also two other states, Nevada and New Mexico, referred to as a supported state-based marketplace. In this particular situation, the state retains many of the functionalities that it had initially set out to accomplish, and I'll go through those in a minute. The federal government is also allowing Oregon to retain 100% of the assessment dollars that are generated from the sale of the individual product through the exchange. So on the next slide, you have a table provided that demonstrates the difference in the functions of the marketplace between 2014 and 2015, given this new supported state-based marketplace focus. What you'll know is that the main difference between 2014 and 2015 is that for eligibility and enrollment and appeals, the top and the bottom line, those functionalities no longer are the state's responsibility for 2015. Those are the functionalities that are transferred to the federal government. You'll note that there are also several asterisks. So agent relations and call center are functions that are shared between Oregon and the federal government. And then also on plan management, the second line from the top, you'll note that there's a small asterisk, and that's because the federal government actually does the final step, acknowledging that a carrier can sell products through healthcare.gov. So the takeaway from this slide is that there is a large part of functionality that the state will still be responsible for managing and operating as we go into 2015. And if the state is allowed to continue the supported state-based marketplace functionality, the state will need to maintain these functions moving forward. So how are we going to do that work? So as originally set out by the marketplace and by the legislature and by the federal government, the marketplace needed to become self-sustaining for 2015. So the table that you have in front, the graph you have in front of you represents the projected revenue from the 2014 assessment that Cover Oregon will be gaining from the carriers. So as you can see, up to this point, we've issued bills totaling $4,326,000 to the carriers for the sale of the 2014 product. And we're projecting by the end of the year that we'll collect $6,246,000, which will be a carryover to fund the operation of Cover Oregon moving forward. So on the next slide, you can see a breakdown of the projected funding for Cover Oregon. So as I stated during the graph on the last page, you can see that there's a 2014 carryover revenue of $6,246,000. We're projecting 2015 revenues, the sale of the 2015 individual product, to be $8,694,000. That's based upon enrollment of 90,000 lives times 10 months of coverage times the $9.66 per member per month assessment. So the total funds for 2015 would total, if we're able to obtain that 2015 projected enrollment, $14,940,000. If you subtract out the requirement of Cover Oregon to carry a reserve of 2.5 months, that would be $2,083,000, leaving an available fund to operate Cover Oregon of $12,857,000.
Madam Chair?
Yes, I understand your hand.
Just to go back for Mr. Patton,
sure.
The $9.86 cents per month, per member per month, I should know the answer to this, and I don't. We don't have to pay any of that over to the feds now because of that's what we were getting. I mean, that's the increased amount that we will be getting, and we were getting something analogous for the 2014 premiums. That doesn't cut out at all because we now are having to go through the federal government site?
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's exactly right. So for 2014, the assessment was $9.38 per member per month. For 2015, the assessment, which is built into the carrier rates, is $9.66 per month. The agreement with the federal government in May that Tina and Clyde Hamstreet were able to arrange was allowing Oregon to retain 100% of that $9.66 for the 2015 open enrollment period. So the answer is yes.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And how many employees do we have with Cover Oregon?
So, Madam Chair, we have approximately 117 employees at Cover Oregon currently. However, the organization is staffed to work within a much larger budget. The allocation of the FTEs were planned based upon a need to own, develop, and operate technology, which will no longer be a requirement for 2015. So the focus of Cover Oregon is really turning to education and outreach, ensuring that Oregonians know what they need to do in order to get the coverage that they're entitled to under the law, that they know how to use the benefits that they purchase when they purchase that coverage, and assisting them in making determinations about the coverage that's most appropriate for them. So in essence, our organization is changing. If you remember back to the creation of the exchange, the goal always was to be self-sustaining for 2015, and there was always planned a dramatic reduction in the revenue that would be needed to run the organization.
But this, if projections hold become actual, it's more than what is what you need for the 2015 year.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, you're right. At our current staffing level, if you simply multiply out our run rate for our salaries and payroll expenses, having a budget of $12,857,000 will not support the size of the organization that we are today.
Will not?
Will not.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Aaron, you probably read in the papers that there are people who are interested in eliminating Cover Oregon and or returning some of those functions back to the Oregon Health Authority. Can you give us an idea of the ramifications of doing that?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I have read those stories. The bottom line is the functionalities of the marketplace are mandated by federal law to be in existence in the state. So regardless of any governance decision that's made regarding Cover Oregon, those functionalities will still need to be here. Cover Oregon is interested in participating with the legislatures, the legislators, the decision makers that will be weighing in on the future of Cover Oregon to ensure that the most appropriate decision is made for those functionalities.
Philip, are you aware of any federal funds that would be lost if that decision were to be made to eliminate Cover Oregon and move it to the Oregon Health Authority?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm not aware of any of the funds that would be lost. Similar to Tina's comment, we are in regular contact several times a week with CMS, SSIO, the IRS. They're very aware of the situation in our state and will continue to partner with us moving forward.
Thank you. Just a comment. You seem very competent and very aware, and appreciate the information you've been sharing today.
Thank you. I just want to go to the next slide, the pie chart, which represents 2014 spending. I can't be clear enough on this one. This is 2014 spending. The reason that I'm providing this is to help tell the story about how we will be changing as an organization for 2015. As you'll note on the left side of the pie chart, the big purple section, 53% of our 2014 spend falls into professional services and IT. Again, Cover Oregon will have no IT responsibility moving forward for 2015. This portion of our spend will go away. So already you can see that compared to where we were in 2014 and where we are going in 2015, we are changing as an organization. Oops. And the last slide I have is regarding budget planning. So this will actually be the third year that Cover Oregon has gone through this budget planning process. It won't be the first time that we've actually approached it. So between September and November of 2014, the Finance and Audit Committee of Cover Oregon will review and make a recommendation to the board regarding the budget for 2015 and 2016. We're required to have the two-year planning. In December of 2014, the board will be asked to adopt the budget for 2015-2016. Then January to April of 2015, the Finance and Audit Committee will review and recommend the administrative charge, so that per member per month for the 2016 plan year. There will be a public rulemaking process to set that charge, which is what's been done in the past two cycles of open enrollment. And the board will approve the final rule language setting that charge. So while I don't have exact projections about our budgeting for the specific areas for 2015, we are actively in that process right now, and this is the timeline we will be following to ensure that it's completed appropriately. So that was the last slide I have. Okay. So.
And it looks like there are no further questions. Thank you very much. I'm sure we will be having another update in December.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. I'll look forward to coming back.
Thank you. All right, let's move on to some really happy news from the Oregon Health and Science University Night Cancer Challenge, and Steve Statham, who's the Chief Operating Officer from the Night Cancer Institute, is here to give us a brief report.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Steve Statham, Chief Operating Officer of the Knight Cancer Institute. Thank you for the opportunity to give you an update this morning. In the interest of time, I'll go fairly quickly through some of the slides. I was going to cover a little bit of background about the Cancer Institute, but I'll go through those quickly unless one of the members of the committee has a question. And then I'd like to give you an update on the Cancer Challenge and where we are with our plan for the next several years, and talk a little bit about the economic impact. So again, very quickly, I'm not going to read the slides for you. The Cancer Institute has been around since 1997, and we did receive a major gift from Mr. and Mrs. Knight back in 2009, We do cover the whole spectrum of the cancer continuum from population science to diagnosis, treatment, research, and survivorship programs. The concept of personalized medicine is not really new anymore, but certainly has changed the way we're approaching cancer, and it is based on a molecular approach and an individualized approach to research and treatment. Dr. Drucker and the Cancer Institute did a lot to advance this field, and we were really the pioneers with the development of targeted therapies, including Gleevec. The first night gift was successful in bringing a lot of scientists to Oregon and also community oncology trials in the form of the SWOG program, which is one of the National Cancer Institute's primary national clinical trials programs for community providers. And we also were an early adopter in next-generation sequencing for cancer patients with our night diagnostic labs. Those are all areas I would love to talk about more, but I don't have the time, so I'm going to go really quickly. I think you're all aware that in 2013, Mr. and Mrs. Knight made a surprise challenge pledge that would commit that did commit $500 million to us if we were able to raise another $500 million by February 2016. We partnered with the state of Oregon, and we're very grateful that the legislature approved $200 million in bonds to build infrastructure needed to help us meet the challenge, and that will count toward the challenge, but we will also continue to fundraise because our original plan was a $1 billion programmatic plan. Our progress to date is very exciting. Counting the state's commitment, we raised $428 million toward the $500 million, so we need $72 million. And we're almost a year into the the challenge campaign, so we're really excited with the progress and the outpouring of support from Oregonians. This slide is kind of busy, but I think we'll give you a sense of the diversity of the kinds of gifts and the location of where the donors are coming from. We're getting a tremendous amount of support from around the state. Some people ask us, well, isn't it really the large gifts that matter? And that's not really the case, because for one thing, the large donors are looking at how we're doing, how the state is responding, and the kinds of support we're getting around the country. And really, the small gifts tell the story as well as anything. And as you can see, we've done very well in terms of the support that Oregonians have rallied around this challenge. And we're really proud of Oregon for doing that. So what is our plan? So the $1.2 billion is a lot of money, but it is planned to be spent over a 10-year period. And the state's investment will be spent on a research building and clinical trial space in a separate building so that we can conduct the research that we're planning to do with this additional funding plus our current research. A portion of the $1 billion will be put in the form of an endowment so we can continue to fund and support the scientists following the 10-year period. The rest of it will be spent on current activities, including recruitments for clinical research so that we can bring treatments to Oregonians more quickly, particularly high-impact clinical trials that aren't otherwise available. The bulk of the money will be spent on what we call molecularly targeted early detection. And I'll come back to that in a little bit, just to spend a little bit of the time on that topic. And then we have $100 million planned for various things, including a statewide community outreach program, what we call the Knight Community, Knight Cancer Community Partnership Program, and an innovation fund that will fund discretionary activities that the director of the Cancer Institute will determine.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Mr. Statham, and I apologize to other OHSU people because I didn't know I was going to ask this question, and normally I warn you. Talk to me a little bit about the statewide community outreach. Sure. I think I made it pretty clear in February when we were considering this that I was concerned about prevention efforts and the fact that we can do a lot upstream to even prevent cancer from happening, let alone detecting it earlier. And it's not that what you're talking about isn't important. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. But there's a lot we could be doing with primary intervention to help people not even get cancer in the first place. So could you talk a little bit more about that piece of it, please?
Certainly, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. Senator. We're really excited about this. What we're planning to do is put $1 million a year into statewide community-based research, prevention, and outreach programs. In addition to the outreach programs that we're currently doing, this program would be a little different in that, at least I've been at OHSU for 16 years, and even though we are always act with the best of intentions, I think sometimes communities would say that we sometimes tell them what to do too much, and so the basis of this is kind of an RFP program in which communities will be invited to request grants of different sizes to help with prevention, outreach, potentially survivorship, the range of cancer programs that are specific needs in their communities, and we'll pair them with faculty at OHSU. In some cases, the communities may not actually know what they need, and they may need help doing a needs assessment. In other cases, they may have done a needs assessment, and they'll say, well, in our community, melanoma is a problem, and we need to do some early intervention around melanoma prevention, how to protect your skin, wearing hats, basic education about sunscreen and risk of melanoma, which is actually a very high incidence in Oregon, as you know, Senator Hayward. Another example would be in other communities, perhaps tobacco cessation might be an issue. So what we don't want to do is put the money out in the communities with kind of a we know best approach. The idea is actually a little bit modeled on the Oregon Community Foundation, if you're familiar with that, with the idea that communities will come together and identify needs and make requests. And we're going to start that RFP process this fall, probably in October, and because we've committed to start the program in 2015. And so there'll be, I think, a range of programs. I completely agree with you that there's a lot that can be done upstream before you get to treatment.
Madam Chair, if
yes.
I may. So just to play devil's advocate for a minute and then to ask another question, $250 million endowment, that gives you, on a 5% rule, $12.5 million a year, roughly, to spend.
Mm-hmm.
So $1 million is about 8% of that, if I'm doing my arithmetic correctly. In fact, I think I am. And that's not bad. But it's also, I mean, having been a researcher myself, I know that $1 million doesn't go as far as we think it does, especially when you divide it up among a larger number of communities. Is the clinical trial infrastructure going to include anything around prevention? Is it going to partner with something like the Oregon Rural Practice-Based Research Network, which is already in place in rural communities around the state and has an established track record for doing high-quality research that is very community-centered? Could you talk about that a little bit more, please?
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator, first of all, we did, in designing this program, we got a lot of consultation from L.J. Fagnan, who heads the ORPRIN program you spoke about. And I think in some communities in particular, it'll be, you know, that partnership will be very active, depending on, again, the particular community and their experience and also where they are with understanding or identifying the needs that they might have. With regard to prevention and outreach, I would say that, again, this $1 million is in addition to grant-based activities that people like Jackie Shannon, Kerry Winterstone, and others are engaged in addition to what would be essentially funded from general funds through the Knight fundraising campaign. So I think we'll continue to do that. Clinical trials range, as you know, from interventional trials with new drugs to prevention trials. Jackie Shannon just got a grant award for basically a dissemination program to bring some new prevention strategies to communities. I can't remember the acronym now, but can get back to you with that. But yeah, it's there's a lot that can be done upstream. I support what you're saying there, and I'm glad that this has been incorporated into our plan. So
thank you, Mr. Stein. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Just to orient you very, very quickly to the locations of the two new buildings that I referred to earlier. One is just north of the new bridge that is going in, the TriMet Bridge and the Collaborative Life Sciences Building. The other is just south of the tram, both in the South Waterfront. The first one will be the research building I spoke of. The second will be a patient care and clinical trials facility in which the cancer program and the clinical trials portion of the cancer program will be housed. I want to just talk briefly why focus on early detection. This gets a little bit, I think, to some of the conversation the senator and I were having. Screening tools are very much outdated, and they lead to both a lot of misdiagnosis, but also a lot of overtreatment. So we have a double-edged sword here. Anybody, and most of us in the room, have to worry about either prostate cancer or breast cancer. So we can appreciate the fact that common tests like mammograms and PSAs are actually very poor tests. And so what we want to do is advance the field of early detection so that the tests are more precise and we have better treatment outcomes because we can intervene earlier and more on the cases we need to and not over-treat in cases we don't need to. We also think it builds on our strengths as a pioneering center in personalized medicine. This is a busy slide, but the main point of the slide is to show that there is a very strong correlation with the number of cases that are diagnosed late and five-year survival rates. And you'll see that, for example, in pancreatic cancer, we have terrible survival rates, and that's largely due to the fact that we don't find it until it's very late. Prostate is a little misleading because while it's true that the survival rates are really good, it's also true that we horribly overdiagnose prostate cancer and intervene in cases where we shouldn't really. Well, most men will get prostate cancer at some point in their lives, but most of them don't have to be treated. We just can't tell which ones do and which ones shouldn't.
Madam Chair. Yeah. Back to prostate cancer, I have a very small interest in that. PSA is not a good marker.
Madam Chair and Senator, it's not a good marker. It's not specific and it's not sensitive. So that means that we get a lot of false positives and we get a lot of false negatives. So it's really, and Senator Steiner Hayward can talk about it probably in more with more scientific expertise than me, but it's really a marker that is a substitute for something going on in prostate. It's measuring something that not directly the cancer. And so we have a correlation there, but it's a very poor correlation. And as a result, we're guessing as to, in a particular case, whether it should be treated or not, or how aggressively it should be treated. And so a lot of prostate cases are cases that, and this the public doesn't really like to hear this because cancer is such a scary thing. Most prostate cases don't need to be treated. We just don't know which ones, unfortunately, because the ones that do, prostate cancer is very lethal, but we can't tell the difference. So distinguishing lethal and non-lethal cancers is one of the goals of the early detection program, and it's an area in the field that we would like to have a high impact on, Senator.
Okay. Well, this is partially personal because I have prostate cancer and had my prostate removed because my grandfather had died of prostate cancer. So
yeah.
So you do that, but I've also been told I've got one more PSA, and then they say I'm clear to go. But you're telling me that may not necessarily be so?
I'm telling you that that it may not necessarily be so. It's probably their best, the best assessment they can give you with the tools they've got.
So what you're going to do is come up with better tools.
That's the idea, Senator.
It took me a while to get to the point.
No, that's a great point. So what is it? We're not exactly sure. That's what's fascinating about this area. We think it will be some yet-to-be-invented imaging technologies. They may be saliva-based. They may be blood-based. The first thing is we have to figure out what we're looking for. And, I think at this point we're not the field, despite all the years of the war on cancer, is not that clear about the early triggers of cancer. A lot of the money in drug development has gone into late-stage therapies, unfortunately. So our plan is to assemble the team and liberate them as much as we can from a lot of grant writing so they can focus on science and actually take a team-based approach, which is not that common in medical research, where people are rewarded mainly for getting grants and pursuing their individual research projects. So that's the essence of what we want to do. We do think that this program will benefit all Oregonians by bringing these scientists to Oregon, hopefully changing the field and advancing the science, bringing this community outreach, additional community outreach program, including clinical trials and prevention and screening to the state, as the senator and I talked about earlier. I wanted to make a brief comment on economic impact. That's not the reason we're doing this, but there was a study done by Eco Northwest that measured economic impact during the construction phase and then on an ongoing basis, and you can see the numbers. I won't read them to you, but it is a positive impact whenever we can bring leading scientists and research programs to Oregon. We don't have a defense industry here. I like to point out that it's much better to have a research industry, but you're still importing dollars from around the country, and that's what this program will do. It does have a multiplier effect, and when we bring faculty to OHSU, it's a little bit like relocating a small company. We want to grow our own, too, but when we hire mid-level and senior scientists, they typically bring a team with them or recruit a team, and there is an economic impact. This is just an example of a senior scientist we've recruited here in the last 3 or 4 years and the kinds of numbers of people that person brought to his lab, and also the kinds of grant funding that person brought. A little bit about our timeline. So the green font shows what's already been accomplished. The rest of the year, I mentioned the community partnership program, which will roll out later this month or early October. 2015, we expect to award the initial grants for the community partnership program, and we'll be designing and planning the construction process for the buildings, and we will continue. We're already in the process of recruiting a director-level person for the early detection program to work with Dr. Brian Druker, our Cancer Institute director. In 2016, February 2016 will be the end of the Knight Cancer Challenge, unless we can achieve our goal sooner, which I hope we can, but I'm cautiously optimistic, but we certainly don't want to assume that. March 2016 is the plan currently for when construction will begin on those buildings. And mid-2018 would be when the buildings would open. But we're recruiting now for the scientists, and we're certainly launching the community partnership program and other things. We're beginning to move on those now that we've had substantial success because we want to hit the ground running. So that's a quick update on where we are. If there are any other questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Well, yes.
And not a question, a comment based on my last question, I suppose, but you know, I've considered for a long time OHSU to be the brightest, shiniest star in the universe of the state of Oregon, and I think this is an absolutely essential move that we're doing here. As I get older, I get more and more of my friends that are impacted, and I have several right now. I've got a friend in Tigard. I was a specimen at their wedding, and she's dealing with an incredibly rare form of cancer right now. And I do know as much progress as we've made, we truly have just scratched the surface. And my hopes for this institute are incredibly high, and we need to make sure that the resources are going to be there. And we stepped up for one bite. We may have to be prepared, right, Senator?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Great. Thank you so much. We're cutting edge. We can be a leader in cancer research. We already are. And so thank you so much, and we look forward to hearing from you in the future.
Thank you.
All right. With that, we'll have some more good news. Presentation on the Boys and Girls Club. And let's have, Tim's coming, I guess, and then Helen Higgins and Tim Sinatra.
It's waiting for the technical support. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. While Patsy ably gets our presentation up, I will just quickly introduce the folks here before you. As I say, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Alliance of Boys and Girls Club of Oregon. Thank you very much for giving us some time this morning to share with you some good news about Boys and Girls Clubs around the state. I'm joined by, to my immediate left, Tim Sinatra, who is the president of the Oregon Alliance. He's also the, his day job is the executive director of the Boys and Girls Club of Salem, Marion, and Polk Counties. To his left is Helen Higgins from Corvallis, the Alliance Secretary and Treasurer. She's the Executive Director of the Boys and Girls Club. I've been involved with Boys and Girls Clubs. I started with Tim's predecessor's predecessor. So I'm old. I've been around a long time with clubs, and I'm happy to be here in the building working with them as they go forward, seeking some assistance probably. We'll probably be back in January to talk to you some more. But with that, I'll turn it over to Tim and Helen for their presentation, and thank you again for the opportunity.
All right. Good morning. Again, I'm Helen Higgins. It's a pleasure to be here. Madam Chair, committee members, this morning we very much appreciate the opportunity to appear before your committee, and we've prepared some presentation materials that help provide an overview of how the Boys and Girls Clubs across the state of Oregon are supporting the development and well-being of our state's greatest asset, and that's our children. So the Boys and Girls Clubs, is that okay on the sound? The Boys and Girls Clubs exist in our local communities because we value and understand how important it is to invest in achieving our mission. And our mission is to inspire all young people, especially those who need us most. We are a committed and passionate group of people that are there to ensure that our kids have a clear path to their future, and more importantly, have the tools and the resources to achieve their goals and to achieve their dreams. Page down here. Here we go. Together, we serve nearly 78,000 youth across the state. We have 40 clubhouses that are located in 20 cities, from Grants Pass to Ontario to the coast. The breadth of our collective reach is unparalleled for after-school programs. Again, we serve roughly 78,000 youth from age 6 to 18, and our impact continues to grow, serving a diverse population, especially those who need us most. And you'll note that roughly 62% of our members qualify for free and reduced lunch. We are especially proud of some growth that we're seeing in our programs around teens. So approximately 29% of our members are middle and high school aged youth. And what we're finding is that it's a special trick to learn how to attract and retain those middle school teens so that it's far more interesting to come to their local Boys and Girls Club and participate in our enrichment programs than to perhaps go home and engage in a game of Halo or Minecraft or watch television. So that's really a growth area that we're starting to see. And what we always tell our community and our youth and the parents is that we'd much rather have them come to our house after school instead of going home to an unsupervised environment. So in Oregon, youth who attend Boys and Girls Clubs do better. We attribute these better than national outcomes to really two key things. And that is care and consistency. Our clubs are open and available to youth for nearly 300 days a year, and we're staffed with paid youth development professionals who become mentors and build trusting relationships with our members day after day and year after year. Our members grow up in their clubs, and they know that they can rely on our doors being open and our staff being present and available. I'd like to note the bullet on the number of meals that are served You'll see that over 500,000 meals and snacks were served to our nearly 78,000 youth this last year. Again, we highlight this to help you understand the scope and the breadth of the services that we provide to youth across the state. So we, the Boys and Girls Clubs of Oregon, let me go down one more here. Oops, nope, not yet. So we, the Boys and Girls Club of Oregon, benefit from over 100 years of youth development experience. From local clubs across our nation, we're able to benefit our clubs in these 20 cities. We also do this through local boards and the ability to meet our community youth where they are. Together, we're developing productive, caring members of our community. And now I'd like to ask Tim to share how we achieve such outstanding results.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Thank you for having us. It's pretty simple what we do across the state and in each local community. It's get the youth who need us the most to the starting line of life and keep them out in front. And there's a comprehensive approach of how we do that. Our program service model focuses on four areas of what we're trying to do. The end goal of what we're trying to do with our youth is really help them be on track to graduate high school, be college ready, have the opportunity to pursue a technical career, if be it, and also be developed the 21st century skills so they're valued employees as they're seeking to achieve their personal and professional goals. We first, as the graphic shows, we meet youth where they're at. 70% of what we do is helping youth achieve their full potential. 15% is intervention, and the other 15% is intervention, where we have kids at very high-level needs come into our clubs, and we can really change the destiny of them very quickly and overnight with ongoing services. After we do that, before you even talk about academics, before you talk even about future, you got to make sure they're essential needs. We have in many of our clubs, even the one locally here, we're serving thousands of youth with full dental care, vision, thousands of meals, as mentioned earlier by Helen, of nutritious, organic, locally sourced meals in a lot of our clubs to make sure they're healthy and ready to go. We have role models. We have over 160 paid staff, 510 part-timers who are working along with thousands of volunteer hours of being supported by the youth we serve. We also focus on three core areas, which is academic success, character and citizenship, and healthy lifestyles. But after that, you know, we asked ourselves, is that enough for kids to be what we call go ready for the future of what's being demanded by a global economy, by a culture of connectivity, by the pace of technology that's outpacing education? And what we provide is transformational opportunities where these youth are getting real-time experiences where we're connecting academics and we're building 21st century skills, also connecting all of that with what the future career pathways look like and what's going to be demanded of them. And with that in mind, it helps us defy the odds for the kids who are struggling in poverty, who don't have all the access or support, or the teachers who are overwhelmed. The clubs become a catalyst to help everyone come together and be successful in achieving those goals. It becomes a continuum of comprehensive services. We found there's no one aspect that you can do in youth development that guarantees success. You have to have a platform of success that just allows all the opportunities or challenges that might come along in a youth's life to be there, and that you can respond to those and really leverage those opportunities for our youth to be the best they can be. One of the unique things that really distinguishes us as an organization across the state is the alliance we have. When mentioned that we have 40 clubs in 20 different cities, we are what we call shovel ready. We can scale on key statewide issues probably faster than most. We have a lot of metrics that we share amongst the clubs because we're constantly learning from the rural clubs to the kind of mid-city clubs to even the urban clubs on what are the key issues going on. The greatest part is that each of our clubs have a local board. That local board is connected to almost every aspect in the community. And from that allows us to really penetrate any of the key issues that might be going on for our youth, because we have the access of those connections and relationships with our boards and so on. We have collaborative training, And it really helps us to serve those kids from 6 to 18. We're the one organization that can have a child who comes in at 6 and stay with us all the way to 18 and help them through all those critical transitions and challenges that comes along life, and also leverage their full potential of having them help focus and have a vision for what their future may allow and bring towards them. One of the things we're looking at now with an initiative is really we're seeing in each of our communities, there's an intensity even beyond what we do as a core that needs to happen for a lot of the kids who are really at odds with really achieving their personal and professional goals. And we've launched not too long ago a program called Training Teens for Tomorrow, and it's on its fifth year right now of where it's an intentional focus of really helping these youth navigate life, be academically successful, and build the future skills to really achieve their future goals. And with that, we have had children, or actually young teens, who have come through and become very successful. And I'll share with you one story in the end. But more so, what we've learned from Training Teens for Tomorrow, when we developed this, and we did about 16 months of research with businesses, educators, everyone in the community, to say if we need to do more for these kids to be successful, what should we be doing? And it was this alignment of academics with building future skills and helping them navigate life. So the Training Teens for Tomorrow was very successful. What we did do, though, we realized that many of the educators and businesses and so on were urging us to replicate that, but with the middle school level, and then replicate that with the elementary level. So we've developed a Great by Eighth program that's being launched this September in the local clubs here to test pilot that and then scale it. Training Teens for Tomorrow has been scaled to Grants Pass, Corvallis, and also
Albany.
Lebanon?
And Albany.
And Albany also. So that's been very successful, and that's one of the benefits of the statewide organization. And so we're really, the intentionality of these three programs is beyond the core of what we're trying to achieve, and we have seen the results that are just amazing, and I'll speak to those right now. In our Training Teens for Tomorrow, in order to get into the program, you have to have anywhere from 3 to 5 serious barriers that if you look on paper, you would say those kids have barely a chance to graduate high school, let alone some of the kids even be alive by the time they get out of high school. And what we've done was put an intensive program service model together to address those. We've had 210 kids to date go through that. You can see the results that are already listed in this PowerPoint, but even more so, what's most interesting to us is what's called sustainable impact. So with Training Teens for Tomorrow, one of the goals is to get them through high school, get them into post-secondary education or employment or technical trade. But what happens beyond that when they exit the program? And so we still provide resources for these young adults as they're going through. And what we've found is some of the smallest challenges, sometimes as much as $500. We've had T3 kids, Training Teens for Tomorrow kids, $500 was going to derail them out of college, and they were in their third year doing very well. But because they have no network, no background, no safety network, no social capital, that was going to stop them.
Senator Steiner-Harry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm really interested in programs like this, well, all your programs, because they sure do exactly what we should do, which is push these interventions upstream. What's your cost per year for these kids? And they're usually in for 3 or 4 or 5 years. And besides money, what keeps you from taking it to scale?
Okay, Madam Chair, Senator, it's a 2-year program, so there's the intensity of 1 year that just changes the destiny for those kids. And mm-hmm. then there's a year of follow-up to make sure that everything we did in the first year continues. The cost of that can range anywhere from $1,200 to $2,000. The difference, the $800 difference, is a paid apprenticeship that we guarantee that becomes the hook for the youth to stay in the program that long, because many of the youth are very interested in employment because there's many reasons for that, and it helps their family and their pursuit of their goals and so on. And scaling is just more of getting a starting point. So we were really had the opportunity through the Youth Development Council and the funding to test pilot, not just we started in Salem to pilot it, but now that it's being scaled, the key thing is to scale it into the community. The community gets behind it, and the businesses start funding it from there. And it's really a seeding of what prevents it from fully being scaled through our 12 organizations across the state. Because what we found here is that we have started this program, we're on our fifth year, and we have private funding now that has actually taken over and have funded it for the next 5 years because the program's been so successful from one donor itself. So the success is there. It's a matter of seeding it, getting the financial support to get it going, and then the communities get around it, they see the success, and it continues.
And we need to be moving on, but in the next the next time that we have you, we should have a bill. Mm-hmm. And Senator Cruz and I had the opportunity to tour the Boys and Girls Club here in Salem, and they're doing some wonderful, wonderful things. Next time when you come, we really do want you to focus on the amount of money that you're asking for and what specifically it will be used for, why you will need it. I want to acknowledge Erin Hubert in the audience, too. She's we're just starting, they've taken over, sort of, a Boys and Girls Club that we're developing in the Rockwood area. And we really need more and more of these outreach to these at-risk kids. So, yeah.
And I'm not going to ask questions because we will continue to, but I just want to say that I've been involved with the Boys and Girls Club of the Umpqua Valley. Mm-hmm. And one thing about these clubs is for my entire life, we are trying to find some way to reach kids. And I know we started early, but the focus on teenagers is huge. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely huge. And you say, it keeps them from going home and playing video games. It keeps them from doing a lot of other things, too, okay? And that's where a lot of the crime happens. But, you know, all the failed efforts we have had in Douglas County to try to find an organization that would reach out and do what the Boys and Girls Club is doing and in Douglas County, this is a massive success. And we are finding ways to keep the teenagers involved, and they become committed, and it's a wonderful thing. So I'm looking forward to seeing what we can do to help with the mission.
And you have a committee here that's very passionate about this, so
excellent. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And all right, next we're going to have an update from the Task Force on the Future of Public Health Services. This is a result of House Bill 2348. Lillian Shirley. Oh, there you are. And we're calling Tammy Bain.
Tammy, this is Sandy with the Senate Healthcare Committee.
Hello.
Hi. You are on speakerphone, and the chair just invited up Lillian. So,
thank you.
Okay.
And to put things in context, Representative Greenlink and I have served on this committee and have been attending all of the meetings. It is bipartisan, but the two members weren't able to attend the meetings like Mitch and I had. But I'm very excited about what's come out of this and looking forward to some significant legislation. And this is your first bite at the apple here.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm going to have Tammy Bainey. Are you there, Tammy?
I am.
Commissioner Bainey is our chair, and I'd like her to start this presentation. Unfortunately, her governmental duties have prevented her from being here this morning with us.
So please introduce yourself, Tammy, and take it away.
Thank you, Senator. Madam Chair and members of the committee, and of course my esteemed Senator Canope, I wanted to thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm chairing a meeting here in my office downstairs at 10, so I do hope that you'll forgive the fact that I'm not there in person. This work is important enough to be there. But let me start just by saying happy Monday, and what a great day in Oregon to be talking about something that is truly bipartisan. I'm excited about the work of the task force. I believe that we've come to something that addresses public safety in terms of what it means for true public health safety in our communities, and have come up with something that I think will also engage the local communities in protecting their communities toward public health issues and et cetera. So the reason why we're here is, yes, Senator, you mentioned that we have the interim task force for us to take a look at public health in the state of Oregon. But I think also we have health challenges that are facing us that we really need to make sure that we're doing what we can to protect and detect infectious diseases. We also know now that there's a growing recognition that where people live, learn, work, and play can be important to their health outcomes, as important as even medical intervention. I think it's also important to note that the state of Oregon is going through significant health care transformation in terms of the medical care that's provided and how that is provided in communities. And I think we also have a recognition that we have a decentralized system in Oregon that results in really varying outcomes and varying funding across the state of Oregon. So I will be discussing the recommendations of the committee, but those are the reasons essentially why I believe this work is important. This isn't just because we're looking at transformation in Oregon. This is because we need to really look at what governmental public health looks like in the state of Oregon and how we have consistent opportunities for that foundational capability in every community across the state. So with that, I'll turn it over to Lillian, who is going to walk you through the slides, and when we get to the recommendations, I will step back in.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Chair and members of the committee, just a little bit on the background. This is a legislative committee that would have originally created 8 public health regions. That House Bill 2348 was amended to become a task force studying the future of public health services in Oregon and to make recommendations to this legislature. Our report is due to the legislature October the 1st, and it will contain the concepts that have been agreed to by the committee. Whoops, I'm going in the wrong direction here. Here we go. Okay. The legislation requires the task force to focus on the following recommendations, which are in your bullet points. I won't read them out, but specifically that we should look at how can we have really appropriate services with healthcare and also with community organizations. And I think the prior to presentations kind of leads to that direction. We are trying to create a system that allows us to work really closely with community-based organizations like the Boys and Girls Clubs, and also to work to forward the mission of things like the Cancer Center at OHSU, which is looking at which parts of the state has different burdens of disease and how can we really work together to address those. The membership of the task force is very broad, and as Commissioner Bainey said, it represents both bipartisanism, both philanthropy, as well as government, as well as academic experts, and spread across the spectrum of the state of Oregon, including CCOs and not-for-profits. So why are we doing this? What are we tackling this? I sent something around, which is a bit of a history of Oregon, a history of public health, and actually little known fact that the whole concept of local health departments and county health departments really came out of some work that was done in Yakima, Washington, at the turn beginning of the last century. And I think that, again, this idea of how can we think more systemically, what we know now is that achieving a healthy community is really the work of all. Many of our statutes and rules around public health in Oregon really go back to the turn of that last century, and we have hundreds of them. Some of them are a little bit contradictory, and we haven't had a really robust look at how the governmental system in Oregon works. We are trying to move our system of local and state public health to really look at how can we impact the largest things for health. So this is an example. You've seen this pyramid before from the public health people. We originally started kind of at the beginning where we have the smallest impact at the top of the pyramid, and we've understood that we all have a place in creating health and trying to move the governmental system down further to the changing context and the longer-lasting protective influences, and also make it easier for us to work kind of with a permeable membrane between those members of our community that are working on poverty, education, housing, other issues that impact health. We kind of feel also that I think to achieve our goals for health for all Oregonians, we have to look at new risks as well. In addition, the framework will help us to look at how do we really prioritize that priority of government to keep people safe. One of the ways that we're describing what is in the report is this conceptual framework for governmental public health services. This is not something that we came up with since December. It's something that's based on last decade of thinking about how can we best work together in public health and protect the public. It's based on some reports that have come out of the Institute of Medicine and work that's been done how to implement this in the state of Washington as well as the state of Ohio and other places around the country. And looking at what we already have in place and the relationships that we have here, how can we build upon the state of our clinical structures that we have and the changes from our clinical transformation and our CCOs and the remarkable progress that we've made just to understand what it is that improves health of individuals and families. This framework helps us look at what it is that governmental public health should do. And down in the foundational capabilities is really some concepts that the task force has really thought through, defined, and debated and heard from many stakeholders of what are the things that, regardless of where you live, work, and play in Oregon, you should be able to count on from the governmental structure. And then where it has foundational programs above, I guess I have this little thing here I can point, like these, what are the things that we need to do or make sure is done, regardless of who the delivering agency is in every community, to ensure that these foundational capabilities are implemented. And the way this is designed, this little red box, says that this is not a limiting recommendation. This is not a limiting framework. That any community across Oregon can do additional things, and that would be kind of the bars that go across the red line. You can do more, but we should guarantee our citizens have what's in the red box, regardless of where they are. And I'll stop there and ask if there's any questions.
Important to say that we spend a lot of time figuring out what these foundational capabilities should be and what every Oregonian should have access where they live. And so this is very, very significant. Any other questions?
So just before I turn it over to Tammy for the recommendations that the committee is actually going to vote on this coming week, these are still draft recommendations, I just want to point out that we'll have a final meeting. It'll take place to vote on these recommendations. And in addition to that, every document, every meeting, all of our minutes, I just want to say are available. If you just Google Future of Public Health Task Force, it'll come up. And all the background information as well as all the public testimony is posted there for people to review and kind of gives you the breadth of the work that's been done over the months. The second, I guess, thing I want to say before I turn it over is we've really understood that what we're doing here in our journey, and I want to thank you, Chair Mona Sandersons, for your participation and guidance in the committee as well. We've realized what we're really talking about is modernizing Oregon's public health system to fit into the reality that we have now. So if there's no questions right now, I'll turn it on to
Steiner Haywood.
Thank you very much. Ms. Shirley, and perhaps Chair Mona Sanderson, have you guys talked about a timeline for this at all and how we're going to assess and what our outcome measures are going to be? I mean, these are, I think, very reasonable and thoughtful foundational capabilities. Have you talked about a process for outcome measures and for evaluation? And this is going to require a certain amount of culture change in the public health departments
Could you talk about those issues?
We spent a lot of time talking about implementation, and I know Representative Greenlick would like a 10-year plan. I would like a 5-year plan. This isn't something that will be actually in the report, because there's a lot that needs to be done to just start the basis.
So, correct. I completely agree with you. This requires, I would say, more than a little bit of culture change. So it's a journey that we have to take together, I think, and we want to make sure that there's no unintended consequences as we move forward as well. In the report that is being prepared for the legislature, the modernizing of Oregon's public health system, there is an appendix which actually speaks to the implementation plan and how we would get there, and what the recommendations are for a governance structure. Specifically, the task force felt very strongly that is the purview of the legislature in some ways, once they get our recommendations, you know, to put some kind of meat on the bones, if you will.
In the report, it'll be much more involved. I just wanted you to get the preliminary introduction to what's going to come down the road. But since we don't have a final report yet, and we will be voting on it, it'll be much more detailed and probably answer some of your questions.
Yeah, I actually read the draft report that I found online last night. I didn't find the appendices, but maybe I didn't look in the right place or they weren't attached to the main report.
Okay.
One of the points that was made in that report is that a bunch of the funding for public health in the state comes from federal sources, and that has often come with strings attached. And so I hope that one of the things that's included in the final report is some thoughts about how we're going to manage funding issues and negotiate with our federal partners. Oregon's very good at getting waivers. So I'm wondering if that's going to be part of this process. Obviously, that may be a too fine a detail, but one does worry about funding.
Well, part of the culture change has to be a culture change within this legislature, because we have totally underfunded public health. I think we're in the bottom.
We're number 46.
Number 46, yeah. Out of what we actually,
I'm not going to
commit
with that.
To public health, and so that's why it has to be a longer implementation plan, because we as a legislature have to understand the importance and the need that public has in the state.
Yeah. Completely.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I think you'll find, while it's, again, it's out of the purview of the task force, but the task force is identifying directions and suggesting different directions to go in, which is then being turned over to all of you in the legislature.
Okay. Great.
So with that, I'm going to turn it back to our chair. Commissioner Bainey, would you like to begin to walk through the final recommendations?
Yes, so I am on page 7 for the recommendations of modernizing public health in the state of Oregon, and I love the fact that we're modernizing versus just trying to attach public health to initiatives that are of today within the state of Oregon. I think there's also a recognition that if you go across the state, a lot of the funding and a lot of the departments that are providing public health have been following funding. And so for us, let's state that there's a needle exchange program that there's funding attached, and wouldn't that be great, because that also helps us be able to provide other services. So we have this hodgepodge of services that are making up our departments today versus having a foundation of what the public health system should look like in the state of Oregon. So first and foremost, in modernizing, we need to agree on the foundational capabilities and programs, and they should be adopted in order for our public health system to function efficiently and effectively. So we need to make sure that emergency preparedness is something that every community has strength to provide, and et cetera. The next would be significant and sustained state funding. As you just mentioned, we are number 46 out of 50. In addition to that, though, we have county general funds that are helping to offset the capabilities of public health in our community. So what role do those funds play in this equation? So I believe that there would be more to come on that. Next would be the statewide implementation of the foundational capabilities and programs, having that occur in waves so that we can learn lessons, we can see some of the approaches that the uniqueness of Oregon, what this might look like in rural Oregon versus what this might look like in, say, Multnomah County. Of course, the systems change and the cultural changes that'll be necessary would be a part of that as well. Next, we have the local public health will need to have the flexibility to operationalize those capabilities and programs through a single county structure, a single county with shared services, or a multi-county jurisdiction. And what we're looking for here is how do we not go through the state of Oregon and suggest regions for rollout of what this looks like? How do we use natural partners within communities that will be able to enhance systems and enhance the service delivery of, so for emergency preparedness, speaking for my own region, we do that emergency preparedness work collectively as a region because that's how our residents live. Some may live in one county but work in another. I believe we have a responsibility to do that planning across those jurisdictional boundaries. So how do we do that in a way in the state that incentivizes that type of work but also enhances the system through that type of flexibility? Multnomah County may not be best served by partnering with another county, so it's allowing that to move forward in a flexible fashion. Next would be the improvements and changes in the governmental public health system be structured around state and local metrics established and evaluated by the Public Health Advisory Board, and we have a FAB 2.2 or 2.0 rather. So there is a in the appendix. There's a realization that we need to really look at what the Public Health Advisory Board for the State of Oregon under the Oregon Health Policy Board can do to help with guiding, helping to establish metrics and etc. But really, the most important piece is making sure that we have consistency and resiliency across all systems within public health for the state, and really honing in on what those foundational governmental public health components look like. So with that, I will pause, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and open it for questions.
Any questions?
Yes, this is really important.
Senator Cruz?
I know we're very front-end on this. Several cautionary things here. The more centralized we get, the less efficient it'll work, and the more we'll be able to streamline. But it was mentioned, I think, previous slide about because public health is a shared service with a lot of counties, and in certain parts of the state, that is going to disappear. We know that. Douglas County, for example, informed the health authority last May that they were turning public health back over to the state. So far, the response from the state has been pretty much non-existent. The handoff was supposed to be October 1st, and the county has pushed it back because they don't know what there's no master plan here. But especially in our timber-dependent counties, the reality is, and it's not just public health, it's a lot of other shared services that really are state responsibility that the counties aren't going to be able to afford anymore. I mean, that's just our reality. And so I'm hoping we're taking things like that into consideration. I mean, you talk about emergency preparedness, for example. Emergency preparedness in Bend is certainly going to be a whole lot different than it is in Gold Beach. Because I doubt if Bend's going to have any tsunamis. So although if Bend has a tsunami, we have much greater problems to deal with, I suppose. So, I appreciate, Madam Chair, that you're looking at a five-year plan. It would be nice if we could get there, but we just need to be very careful. Sometimes when we tend to regionalize things and we tend to drop the things that we need to do. I know one of the concerns in Douglas County right now is, quite honestly, all the relationships that have been built up with all of the other agencies and the nonprofits and everything else, and turning it back over to the state. How do we make sure those things stay in place And so these are the things I'm concerned about as we move forward with this. But for a lot of our state, this has hit a point of critical mass as far as local governments being able to afford to continue to carry their share of the load. So
that's why this modernization is so timely, because when we have counties that say, give me a break, we can't do this, and really the state can't do it either. I mean, it really needs to be at the local level. So hopefully we're going to be able to progress in. We had a lot of input from a lot of different people all across the state, because they all have concerns.
Madam Chair, just a quick comment. I was one of the chief sponsors of this bill, and I'd really like to thank you, Representative Greenlick, Ms. Shirley, Commissioner Bainey, and all the other members for your really hard work on this really important thing. So thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we, Mark Mayer is has been attending the meetings and is in the process of drafting the legislation to make sure that it, and he says that we need to modernize the statutes, because we have statutes 100 years old that aren't even apropos. So,
Madam Chair, we could go to any of the books and find that very same thing exists.
Yeah,
so.
That's true.
Lillian?
Yeah, we can't do that.
No.
Okay. All right. So,
Commissioner Bainey?
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
You too. All right.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we'll move on to state of palliative care, and we have Woody English
is on the phone, and you need to call.
And Addie Goldberg.
Is Woody there?
Are you going to go first, or is he?
I'm going to go first. Okay. So go ahead. I'm hoping
he's still there.
I know he had a meeting, so
yeah,
he might not be there.
And we're running behind.
Yeah. Well, with
go ahead.
With that, I just want to thank Madam Chair and the committee for inviting us to get to talk about something that oftentimes people don't like to talk about, which is end of life. And so, in the absence of Woody, I am Eddie Goldberg. I am the co-chair of COHO, which is Choosing Options, Honoring Options, a grassroots organization in southwestern Oregon. I'm also a palliative care social worker at Rogue Regional Medical Center, whose plate isn't full enough, so I thought I'd get a dissertation in social work, or a PhD in social work. I'm writing my dissertation right now on palliative care. So, in a phase of life that's really surrounded by technology, I didn't bring any technology.
All right.
I'm going to tell you a story. I'm going to tell you the story of Robert and Laura, who are a couple I met about 3 months ago in the hospital. Robert and Laura moved to Oregon from California to be closer to family. Robert was 70 and Laura's 68. And there was hope that there would be some reconciliation with Robert's children. This is a later in life marriage, and the couple was looking forward to reconnecting with family. While unpacking, Robert had a heart attack, and they did a resuscitation in the field, and he was brought to the hospital, non-responsive. This was not the move that they had anticipated. Robert didn't have a pulse because he didn't need a pulse. He was a healthy man who golfed, who was physically active. He was 70 years old. And a pulse is really designed for someone who we anticipate has a year or maybe a bit more, but is facing a life-threatening, altering disease or diagnosis. So he wasn't appropriate for a pulse. But he had, unlike a large number of our population, had filled out an advance directive with his wife. And it had a lengthy conversation with her about his preferences regarding life support, regarding life-sustaining treatment, if there was not a good likelihood that he would be resuscitated. Given the family rift, the children were hoping that, in fact, Dad could be resuscitated and that they would get that opportunity to spend more time with him. So my conversation with the family was a lot about conflict, about this advance directive that Laura knew she had but couldn't find. And so here's where I want to talk to you about the gap that we have. Oregon is the national leader in Pulse. We are recognized for having developed the document. We are recognized for our e-registry. We are recognized as the sort of foundational state with West Virginia regarding end-of-life preferences. Pulse don't apply to most people, and most people end up in the hospital not because they thought they were having their final year of life, but because of a moment like Robert. And so what do we do with Robert and his family? And that's why I'm here to talk to you, to give our state the opportunity perhaps to become the leader, not just in Pulse, but to really the whole conversation that faces us at the end of life. We have an advanced directive document. I use it daily in the hospital. It's not as user-friendly as one would hope. It's difficult to understand, and if you're in the moment of crisis, it's impossible to understand. And so I am trying to help people navigate that. So I'm here to ask the state to consider that we broaden our expertise nationwide, that we become the experts not only in the Pulse conversation, but in that preference of life conversation that all of us face. For me, when my kids got their driver's license is when I felt like I needed to start having this conversation with them. And so I want to tell you a little bit about what COHO has done in southwestern Oregon, and then to talk to you a little bit about a wish list. So COHO was a grassroots organization that didn't exist 5 years ago when the hospital system was going through its certification with JACO. We did not have enough.
Say again what COHO stands
for. Choosing options, honoring options. Lovingly
known
as
COHO. Fish, but that's a whole other
Pardon?
I said it could also be a fish, but that's a whole
I know,
other
and then we start to talk about whether it's upstream or downstream if it's a COHO, and I don't know where we move the conversation. But anyhow, so Choosing Options, Honoring Options, or COHO, is a grassroots organization that didn't exist 5 years ago. JACO was doing its certification for the hospital system, and we did not have enough advanced directives Pulse on file. So we really gathered some of the local expertise to pull together how can we get these conversations embedded in a different way. So when we look at the statewide registry for 2010, 5.7% of Jackson County, Oregon had a Pulse. After 2 years of COHO's intervention in 2012, 14.9%. had a Pulse, which is a significant increase. And when we look at a comparable county, Deschutes, who started in 2010 with 4.1, 8.9 had it 2 years later. So we surmise that COHO's efforts did have an impact. 2013, the registry calculated information a bit differently. We do know that 1,260 additional Pulse were sent into the registry at that time. COHO really facilitates the conversation not just about Pulse, but about advanced directives as well. And so, in part, what I'm asking is for some help. We need the systemic support. We know that the state embraced the Pulse, and as a result, it legitimized the conversation. And so now I'm asking for your assistance in broadening the focus of the discussion. My wish list, if I had my wish list, it would be a document that's user-friendly, that if an individual not in crisis took it home and read it, it would make sense and they would understand the language. It would address CPR. It would talk about differentiating end-of-life circumstances in a way that gave examples that made it a little bit more understandable. That it could be used in a crisis situation in the hospital with greater facility. It would be lovely if Laura didn't spend her final moments with Robert trying to go through moving boxes. If she had had an e-registry or an e-advanced directive, that we would have been able to access Robert's end-of-life plans and hopes just as we could have had he had a Pulse via his advanced directive. So we'd like to come back to you with a more comprehensive proposal for the state to close the conversation gap or broaden the conversation gap. We'd like to think of Oregon maybe as the first conversation zone in the United States, where end-of-life care could really focus on care and not sorting through moving boxes or file drawers to find documents. So,
thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I couldn't agree with you more. As a physician and as a family member of who went through this with my dad. And, you know, fortunately we had had that conversation, and we ended up writing his own advance directive because we didn't think the forms were useful at all. And his doctor loved it because we talked about his values, which is at least as important as the technical details of whether he wanted to be intubated or not. Is there a model from another state or another country that you think meets the criteria that you're proposing for advanced directives?
Well, you know, Five Wishes is adopted by 42 states. It is, Oregon is not one of them. You know, our language is in the statute and it's very specified. I think the committee wants to come back and really wants to research this and develop this with language that, you know, part of what I do as a palliative care social worker is I'm well aware that the language that we use is a foreign language to most people when they get into the hospital setting or the physician setting, and we'd really like it to be accessible. You know, it's written academically at a level that's way too high. Most people don't know what the word resuscitate means. Yep. So when you ask, do you want to be resuscitated, that requires a lot of explanation. So I feel like we need to come back to you with a user-friendly document that does explain what we're asking.
Could you provide the committee with a copy of that Five Wishes
Absolutely.
Version? Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Yes, Senator.
Madam Chair, but when I look at palliative care, it's not just an end-of-life decision. It's decisions as far as quality of life going in. So I just want to make sure, you know, even when the person still is in a position to make their own decisions, to be fully informed of the risk of going this direction, and maybe accepting reality and going in a way that really enhances quality of life for whatever time's left. So for me, that's the biggest part of this thing. So,
Senator Cruz, I want to quote you again and again. I think people often confuse and mistake palliative care for hospice.
Right.
People can engage in palliative care while they pursue curative treatment.
Mm-hmm.
That palliative care is best delivered in our state, in any state, at the time of diagnosis, and we walk the journey with the patient so that decisions and choices and forks in the road are laid out early on so that patients can look at that early on and say, if it gets to this, this might be a choice you face.
Right.
And I think oftentimes in the crisis of the moment, people haven't had the opportunity to sort through those kinds of issues. So thank you for bringing that up.
And we've had to deal with that in my family at a time or two. But I think, I mean, to a degree, we're talking about a culture change as well, because medical people like to cure everyone, you know. And God bless them for having that attitude, but that's not always necessarily the best choice.
Not all of us feel that way, Senator. Sometimes curing is exactly what you said, which is providing spiritual.
But it is to a degree a culture change for a whole lot of folks.
I agree.
Okay.
Yeah, I do too. I think this is the beginning of a culture change. As we have legislation that supports these conversations, it's a way to begin that culture shift. So thank you.
Great. All right. No further questions. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
And this is a topic that has a great interest, I think, on both sides of the House and the Senate. We'll be looking forward to getting the Five Wishes from you.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right. Now we'll move on to the status report on addictions and mental health, new investments. Another good topic. Another good news informational hearing, right?
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pam Martin, and I'm the Director of Addictions and Mental Health. And this is my update to you is based on quarterly reports that we've received between April and June, or May and July. And I hope that you've received the accompanying information. We tried to summarize because we have very short time today. So what you should have is a summary of the community investments for the kids' side and for adults.
Not sure.
This one?
Yeah,
no,
that's her PowerPoint.
Okay. Right, and then we had several handouts.
Yeah, it's
handouts.
In here, I think.
It's on
in here.
It's on OLIS.
It's on OLIS. It's, I saw it here.
That's all right. Go ahead.
Okay.
Information one and two.
Yes. I think so the purpose of the new investments was to invest in a coordinated system of care, keeping kids healthy with an emphasis on prevention and early intervention, which I hope to show you how that's playing out in the state, and to keep behavioral challenges becoming chronic illnesses and interfering with the educational progress of little kids, and also to help adults with mental illness live fully and successfully in the community. So my first update is on the Early Assessment and Support Alliance, ESA, where we made an investment of almost $2 million. There were originally 16 ESA programs in Oregon, and now there are 23, covering 30 out of our 36 counties. We're really we've always gotten great reports from ESA, but this keeps kids out of the hospital at a critical time in their life so they can go back to school, and we have a youngster saying, "ESA saved my life." And often those kids end up going and becoming the peer counselors for the next wave of kids. Our next investment was in technical assistance for youth and peer-delivered support. And this is an important movement to include kids and youth in helping other kids and youth, and we have an expanded contract with the Oregon Family Support Network and with Youth Move as subcontractors. And Youth Move in particular has been using social media to reach kids and expanding the peer network. A Youth Move, for example, was responsible for the tech fair at Reynolds High School this summer, and we helped support that in doing that. Peer-delivered supports is something that the Oregon Family Support Network is working on with a grant of about $500,000. And the next one is our youth adult community hubs. One thing that we have in a report, in addition to just finding diversion from hospitalizations, for kids who didn't quite reach the criteria of the ESA program. So in other words, their symptoms may have been, you know, subacute symptoms, but still, it's an important layer of services, because kids who aren't eligible for ESA will be eligible for the youth hub. It's also started some really wonderful community collaborations. So, for example, Trillium has put some funding in for a nurse and a nurse practitioner at the site of one of the youth hubs. And so we hope to see more of those partnerships. The school programs, the access to mental health services through the schools is also extremely important. And there we have a partnership with public health and other state and local agencies. And our goal is to have mental health services in every school-based health center. We have a report from Clatsop County about a kiddo who is got help and avoided an expulsion, which avoids all the rest of the educational interruption and social interruption. And those are the kind of hopes we have for that program.
All of these counties, then, they submitted requests for the money, and then you went through them and decided which were valid, would have good outcomes, et cetera. How did they get the money?
Madam Chair, that's exactly correct. Now, in some cases, we had funding for every single program that had submitted a letter or an award request. In other cases, we did have to make choices. Some of these programs require a large startup. The sort of community teams, the wraparound services, do require startup money. So investing in the crisis services as well. So investing large amounts of money, by large I mean $500,000 or perhaps a little more, a little less, is necessary to get some of these programs up and running and able to start billing and to have some sustainability. But you're exactly correct. Using the Kessler formula to distribute some of these funds would not have made sense for a lot of these programs.
Thank you.
I would say that the challenges that we're seeing in these early reports, we can see clearly in the System of Care Wraparound Services and ACT, where they're having some difficulty hiring. And I just wanted to say that. This parent-child interaction therapy is part of our early intervention strategy. They are increasing the number of certified trainers around the state, and the reports we get are really interesting. There was a four-year-old who actually trashed the office of the intake therapist, and then later the parents completed the program, and we have a child who's now able to sit still and learn and be in school. We see kids who had a lot of early hospitalizations who are at risk for behavioral issues and educational problems, who parents are creating some mastery, and then the kids, you're seeing vocabulary increase. So I've seen three really interesting reports about the successes of this program, and I would say that we'll see the same kind of success with collaborative problem solving. Even though it's a small grant, it helps with outreach and training around the state.
Just going back to the mental health, I noticed that there was money given to several coordinated care organizations. It's the wraparound.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, that is absolutely correct. There were several areas where the coordinated care organizations already held funding in assertive community treatment and in the wraparound. So we're contributing to the robustness of those programs. I wanted to particularly call out. The Opal K line. This provides primary care physicians with support when they're treating complex child psychiatry cases. And what I wanted to tell you is, as of July, 510 primary care physicians had signed up for this service. And what this service does is provides telehealth by simply a phone call between an arranged phone call for a case conference with a primary care doctor anywhere in the state and a child psychiatrist. And
will we be able to track the number of physicians and patients that accessed that and actually used it?
Madam Chair, absolutely. That's part of their contractual requirements is to do that kind of tracking.
And when was this one?
This report was from July, and what I had.
This July. Okay.
This was as of July.
Okay.
They had signed up that many people. I really don't have time to tell you about the wonderful things that are happening in the tribes. Each of the nine tribes submitted a unique program based on their particular needs and infrastructure. We can make those available. Our mental health promotion and prevention is also very particular to the area of Oregon where the money is going. Some programs are providing refugee support. Some programs are partnering with the National Alliance on Mental Health. Some are providing more mental health first aid. The crisis services information will be mostly gathered with our new data system, but we have an early success in Marion County where we had a number of people who were being sent to the state hospital for aid and assist evaluations, and and a lot of work done by that community and some great partnerships and the development of their crisis team, they have had, as far as I know, no one sent to the state hospital in the last couple of months while their program has been up and running. Jail diversion is the same thing. Early reports, and we have a gentleman who had had 150 arrests, mostly for riding the TriMet without paying. And he was sleep. This is amazing. He was sleeping on a pile of broken glass. Has a TBI, medical problems, major depression. And the jail diversion program worked with TriMet around his charges and have some done some other things. And he has had no arrests at all. We have a lady in Yamhill County who had called 911 47 times. And their crisis, their jail diversion services worked with her. And she had been charged with what's called theft of services. Like if you call services like 911 or a SWAT team inappropriately enough. And she has had no recent incarcerations or calls. She's been had services wrapped around her in her home as a result of that. Housing, also a lot of early successes. Had a gentleman whose walker had been homeless for years, who is now through this program in his own home. In Jefferson County, we have a woman who had been living between motels and her car, who now has housing and works at a local deli. And we're going to talk more, I think, later today about our NAMI, ORPA, Oregon Health Authority collaboration. They put out some competitive funding bids. They have had 10 responses for their supported housing projects and 2 responses for respite care. And that group is in the process of evaluating those responses. Supported employment. Very, very important. Most people with mental illness want to work, and they want to do something meaningful. And we have a woman named Heather who's told us we can use her story. She worked at McDonald's for 7 years, and now she's an ophthalmologist technician. She started as a receptionist, and she was just so wonderful that they sent her to tech school, and she has a driver's license, and she's doing well. And so we have a very strong evidence-based supported employment program in Oregon, and this just was able to expand it. We said in this early slide that we wanted to add at least 4 regional ACT teams. We have, in fact, added 11. And we have, in fact, added a forensic assertive community team in Multnomah County. And to our knowledge, we added additional funding from the block grant. To our knowledge, we have the only and the first Native American ACT team in the United States, and that's through NARA. And there are 60,000 Native Americans living in the Tri-County area, and plenty of people with high need. So that's a really exciting outcome. Next steps are to keep reviewing the process and outcomes. We're trying to standardize the reports so they're easier. We also are setting up a trauma-informed Oregon collaborative through OHA and the Portland State University, which is not mentioned in this report, and more to come at our and when we have a report to do to you in December.
Great. Yes, Senator Shields.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if you could comment on any focus on culturally specific AMH investments beyond the Native American community.
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, members of the committee, I think that's a really good question, and we do have some that are apparent because we're funding the Asian Health Center, for example, which I think is doing some great work. So we do have some areas that are targeted, but I feel that we have a real deficit in that area, and we need to do more work around that. We can call out the programs that are specifically targeted in that way, but we need to have some other strategies, and we're trying to address that in our behavioral health strategic plan, which we're in the process of developing.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks so much, Pam.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. All right. Let's go to the concerns of families with children, adolescents, and young adults with mental health challenges. Jerry Gabe, and Julie Majors.
Okay, he's got handouts. Who will the
got his stuff. I've met with him several times. Well, not all of them, a lot of it. I've met with him a couple of times. Thank you.
Yeah. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Chairperson Mona Zonderson, Vice Chair Krause, esteemed members of the committee. I need to get my glasses. Good morning. My name is Jerry Gabe. I am a member of the NAMI Oregon State Board of Directors, co-chair of Providence Health System's Collaborative Council for Behavior Health, and co-author of the Oregon Psychiatric Physicians Association's Suicide Prevention Checklist, which I believe you've been previously provided by staff, and we also have a packet that we've given the committee administrator. Dr. Stuart Newman and I received the Oregon Psychiatric Association's Access Award for 2013 for our work with the checklists. But most importantly, I'm the father of a daughter affected by mental illness. Please let me take a moment to tell you about her. Susanna was delightful from the moment of her birth, pretty, cheerful, with a smile that was truly infectious. She loved to travel and was fluent in Spanish. She was semifinalist at the 2006 state speech and debate tourney, a pole vaulter and sprinter on the track team, and valedictorian of Hood River Valley High in 2007. Yet early in her junior year of high school, she came home, and having listened to a guest speaker in her health education class, asked us to take her to a counselor. She was diagnosed with clinical depression and given meds that did never, ever seem to work or work well. In December of her senior year, her counselor called us to say that Susanna had been cutting herself and might be suicidal. The counselor arranged for her to be admitted to the Secure Adolescent Psychiatric Unit at Providence, at that point at Providence, Portland, on Gleason. Her 10 days in the unit appeared to help greatly. She returned home the same ebullient child that she had earlier been. But even though we requested some sort of partial hospitalization or intensive outpatient program that would enable her to continue the group sessions and individual psychiatric visits that had been so helpful to her, no program was available to us then, nor is it today. Back in the gorge, with very few mental health resources available, she slowly regressed. She was very proud of being accepted into the Honors College at the U of O with a presidential scholarship for full tuition, room, and board. But there she seemed to retreat more and more into herself. In the spring of 2010, just after her 21st birthday, she suffered a psychotic episode which resulted in her being placed in the secure psychiatric unit at Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene. 1 month after her discharge, 1 day after having missed the only appointment that the hospital made for her, she took her life. So why am I here today? Because I want to make you aware of three things that might have saved my daughter's life and which might save others in the future. The first would be much greater communication between providers and the families by blood or affinity of their patients. The problem is more than just HIPAA, even though some providers cannot think out of that box. Providers are just not accustomed to communicating with families, largely due to a misunderstanding of HIPAA, although there are other reasons too. Providers must be encouraged to seek authorizations to communicate with appropriate supporters of the patient and then actually communicate. It's a cultural change, as has been referred to several times today. I'll give you one quick example of this problem. At Sacred Heart in Eugene, Susanna did sign a release to communicate with us, which she had always done before as well. Her mother and I spent 8 days down there, Easter week of 2010, and we kept asking the psychiatrist and the clinical director when she would be discharged and indicating to them that we wanted to participate in the discharge planning and certainly be there for when she's discharged. We kept hearing they didn't know when they were going to discharge her. On Easter, we told staff that after our visit to her, we were going to go back to our jobs, but again reiterated we wanted to be there for discharge. So we left on that Easter Sunday afternoon, 2010. The next morning, at about 10 in the morning, her mother got a call from the hospital that they had already discharged her. So again, we're not talking only about HIPAA. And then, and I'm not going to get into HIPAA today, although Senator Knope, if you're in Bend tonight, you know at St. Charles there's a panel on HIPAA, and I'm on that, and we'll have a lot to say about HIPAA. But in any case, it's an issue of being encouraged to communicate. Second issue is continuity of care. The availability of step-down programs that can continue the successes of more restrictive environments. As I mentioned from Susanna's stay at Providence Portland during her senior year. Right now, for many children in this state, there are no good alternatives in terms of step-down care. And it, particularly with private insurance, there is no partial hospitalization available to many in this state, even in Portland. And as I indicated, parents are not sufficiently involved by professionals so that they know what to do. We need incentives, again, for provision of care at levels higher than outpatient level but less intense than hospital setting. The third of the three things that I think could make a difference, it would be better coordination of care or case management. Susanna left the hospital, and we, her parents, were provided no resources, no referrals to support groups, no information on her high risk for suicide. Training at the medical practitioner level for this could be improved, whether it be for primary care doctors, ER doctors, or actual mental health therapists and psychiatrists. Like many other rural teens, Susanna saw at least 8 different professionals in 3 different cities over 4 years. There was no one to coordinate her care, so she didn't drop through the cracks. Her mom and I might have, had anyone taken the time to communicate with us in depth as to the nature of her illness, the warning signs and risk factors, and the actions we could take to promote her recovery. We were the only ones with either the time or the level of concern to do this, but we were ignorant of what to do, as are so many other parents. We were well-educated parents in responsible professional positions, but we were not educated in this field. And mental illness knows no socioeconomic or educational distinctions. Sadly, my story is not unique. I speak with many parents across the state, and this situation is more common than not. There are many small acts which the legislature could take to improve the situation, and we'd be very happy to work with any of you who are interested in that. For now, I'd just like to say that although I am very sad every day of my life, I'm also deeply grateful for having had the presence of this brilliant, delightful child in my life. I hope that each of you and everyone in a similar position may keep these lights in your lives, and I'm devoting the rest of my life to help make that come true. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have Pam in the audience, Pam Martin, and I mean the three things, I don't know if part of the strategic plan involves the HIPAA talking about HIPAA. Maybe that's federal. We can't do much about it, but still, that is an issue. I've experienced it myself. So, and then the continuity, step-down care, I think there is some focus there, but we certainly aren't adequately funding, as well as the resources. And then the better case management. Be wonderful to be able to have that. So thank you so much for being so clear and articulate on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good morning, Chairperson Mons Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, esteemed members of the committee. Suicide is not easy to talk about because it touches our pain centers so deeply and profoundly. I know because I talk to a lot of people about it as an employee with NAMI Multnomah, on multiple consumer advisory councils, and in the role I've taken on as an advocate for families. I'm impassioned about this topic because there are implications and consequences that families and young people experience as a result of us not being willing to earnestly explore doing better than we're currently doing. I want to thank all of you for your time today listening. My name is Julie Majors. I'm the mother of two young adults who are thoughtful, kind, talented, and ambitious. My son is 23 years old and a master's student at U of O with a bright future ahead of him in physics. My daughter just turned 20. She works full-time at a veterinary clinic, and she just got a promotion to vet technician. She's gifted in working with horses, and she has a bright future ahead of her. Her ambition is to return to college and to work as a psychiatric nurse. 3.5 years ago, when she was just 16 years old, she'd been spiraling downward with anxiety and depression. In fifth grade, she struggled with social anxiety. In middle school, she was withdrawing into darkness and cutting herself. By her junior year of high school, her only strategy left to relieve her pain and anguish was suicide. She had not been entirely untreated like so many others who have suicidal ideation. We were seeking guidance from many people to help her meet the day-to-day expectations of school, home, her social life, and to address her health challenges. Primary care, exercise, nutrition, extra help at school, counseling, tighter rules and looser rules, most everything that parents try in order to raise their children to become successful young adults, we were trying. I heard concerns expressed by her teachers and doctors. I'm really concerned about your daughter. Your daughter seems depressed and withdrawn, and if she works really hard this term, she can catch up. However, there were many barriers to getting the right care at the right time and with the right knowledge by the providers. The night my daughter swallowed 3 bottles of acetaminophen, ibuprofen, and over-the-counter cold medicine, enough to destroy her kidneys and liver and to stop her heart from beating, I came to the hard realization that I was the only person who was going to act on the concerns and to fight to ensure that her needs would be met. At the ER, they stabilized her medically, and then without psychiatric assessment, they told me they were preparing paperwork to discharge her back to home. I insisted on more intensive care and pushed back enough that they found a bed in acute care at Legacy Emanuel's Adolescent Psych Unit. In her 11 days there, they stabilized her, put her on a trial of new meds, and after a checklist of tasks she completed with ease, they discharged her back to my care. They didn't do, in my opinion, a reasonable evaluation of her, and they definitely did not prepare me realistically for her increased risk of suicide. 2 weeks following that discharge, she had an explosive psychotic episode and a second suicide attempt. We returned to the same acute care where they stabilized her again, weaned her off the meds, and prepared yet again for a discharge without adequate evaluation or a longer-term coordinated care plan. This time, I was unwilling to yield to the protocol to move her to the least restrictive setting, which was my home, and the barriers to a clinically appropriate step-down treatment plan. They found her a placement in a residential setting where I insisted on a thorough evaluation as well as my involvement in her treatment process. 30 days later, our entire team created a comprehensive care plan that considered her clinical, educational, and social needs, family supports, formal supports, and informal community-based supports. A year later, my daughter walked with her classmates and graduated high school with a regular diploma. We were not free of more ups and downs in the years that followed, but what we did have were plans, we had strategies, tools, and resources to overcome any of those challenges that we did meet. You might be asking yourselves, how did I know what to ask for and how to ask for it so that our needs would be met? I can tell you that with my child's life on the line, with 2 suicide attempts within 1 calendar month, I pulled together everyone I knew who might play a role in helping us. In the years preceding, I had been working for the Archimedes Movement, the nonprofit organization founded by Governor Kitzhaber to build awareness and civic engagement around health reform. I worked for a woman who was well-versed in case management and the pitfalls of a broken healthcare system, who just 2 years prior had been immersed in the same children's mental health system with her own teenage son. I had a highly skilled therapist who was willing to work out a generous repayment plan for the dramatic increase in services I needed from her, and I had a natural support system accessible to me that helped me learn what to say to whom and what to do at each juncture. They helped me through the most frightening and traumatic experiences of my life, and without them, I'd be telling you a different story. With their help, both my daughter and I have learned how to advocate for reasonable and clinically appropriate care, to engage professionals, and to navigate the broken system. As all of you know, very few families are in a position to tap similar resources. I have numerous details of what was helpful and what was harmful and how we've been treated over the past several years, and I tell these stories to motivate change. I tell the stories of what worked for us because I want that for others. If my daughter had not survived, you'd be hearing another tragic story, and we'd all perhaps be wondering helplessly, what do we do? My daughter's and my story shows what can be done, and that's why I keep telling it. As legislators, you hold some power to shape the stories of families and young people to look more like mine rather than that of my colleague Jerry's. Stories of hope rather than despair and loss. The things that Jerry stated that might have made a difference for his daughter did make a difference for my daughter, in so much as I, the parent, was successful at insisting that they be implemented. Greater communication between providers and families, continuity of care with clinically appropriate step-down treatments, a meaningful inclusion of family preparation at discharges, and a comprehensive and integrated longer-term care planning approach. These best practices saved my daughter's life. However, very few parents know what these practices are, nor have the natural supports or perhaps the personality to aggressively persist with a system that is not consistently implementing the best practices of their trade. These produce better health outcomes. We believe what's called for is a genuine and in-depth dialogue that explores the implications of us doing the same things we're doing as compared to what is possible if we commit ourselves to creating real change for all kids in our state. There are many people who are living these experiences and are willing to help inform the policy changes that can make a real difference for families. I want to thank Representative Kenny Geyer for supporting Jerry and myself today in coming to present with you, and for all of you for your attention and time on the topic.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's critically important.
David Fuchs.
And Howard Klink.
Howard Klink and Patrick Curran. They'll be talking about housing with services, a new model of long-term care presentation.
This is exciting stuff. I've been talking to these guys for a long time. This is cool stuff.
Good morning. My name is David Fuchs. I'm Chief Executive Officer of Cedars-Sinai Park. With me is Patrick Curran, who is the CEO of Care Oregon, and Howard Klink, who is the Housing with Services Project Director. And we're delighted to have an opportunity to provide you with a short briefing on a project. I first want to address the title in the agenda, because it's referred to as a long-term care. And I want to clarify that Housing with Services is not long-term care. It is home and community-based health care with an eye towards helping to keep people out of the long-term care system, reducing participation of individuals in inappropriate use of emergency rooms, and reducing rehospitalizations. So it is health care that is making an effort to assist at the community-based level in making Oregon version of healthcare reform work, and we're very pleased to have an opportunity to do that. I've been involved in human services for 42 years. And when I first entered the field, the executive officer of the organization I went to work for said, "Welcome to this crazy business." And I thought he meant the clients. But what I realized very quickly is that's not what's crazy. What's crazy is the fact that there are all of these regulatory silos that cause organizations to not collaborate and to work together effectively. Collaboration does happen frequently on the individual basis, but it doesn't often happen on the institutional or the structural basis. This project is an effort to try and promote that, to create a new model for collaboration and coordination of services at the community level, and to work with insurers in the healthcare system to allow people to effectively manage their own health care, and to create a model which can be replicated and regulated by the state once we've had a chance to prove the model effective. So we're looking forward to that opportunity. The basis of what we're thinking about has to do with what the research literature tells us about who is in affordable housing, particularly among seniors. And what the research has shown us is that seniors are twice as likely as elders living in their own apartments on their own to need help with health care, activities of daily living, and so on. I didn't put it in this slide, but they're four times more likely to have that need as compared to individuals living in their own homes. So it is a very challenging population in need of significant services. We took a look at the requirements of the Affordable Care Act and the desire of a system change that required a level of coordination at the community-based level, and determined that we would want to pursue that. Cedars-Sinai Park is a provider of health care, long-term care, and community-based services to elders and people with disabilities. We conducted a needs assessment of the four buildings that we brought into this project, and what we found was 30% of the individuals had mental health problems, a good 15% of them had need for assistance with activities of daily living, about 10% of them were triple eligibles, Medicare, Medicaid, and nursing home eligible, a really significant population in terms of health care needs. We also saw an extremely diverse population, many of whom experienced barricades or obstacles to care by virtue of the fact that they came from ethnic and linguistic minorities that made it difficult for them to provide services. And we developed a determination to pull together a group of providers to be able to have an impact on these care needs and create a formal and structural way to move forward with an institutional change. We initiated the discussion in 2010. In 2011, we were thrilled that the state helped to co-sponsor a forum, what we refer to as a summit on this issue. We received strong endorsements from the director of the Department of Human Services, the Oregon Health Authority, and the governor's office. We're all supportive to the project, and we've been moving forward ever since. We are focusing primarily on the social determinants of health. How can we provide a cultural context in which care can be provided more effectively, where community inclusion can be facilitated, where there's equitable access to care and increased resident involvement in care. In other words, we want to give the individuals who are receiving service that sense of agency where they can direct their own care, where they have choice and can either opt into our services or know that there's a base of services that they can tap into should they need to do that. Let me turn to Howard.
Okay. My name is Howard Klink. I'm project director for the Housing with Services Project. I'm going to give you some brief headlines on what the goals of the project are and what the project actually looks like. And then Pat Curran's going to talk to you a little bit about the partnership that's been developed. The goals, you've got a full outline of the goals in front of you. The primary subset goals that I want you to think about are reduced healthcare costs and improve health outcomes. The whole project, even though we've got some more detail that we've represented in our grant applications and our full program project plan, we're really focusing on improving health outcomes for the individuals that are participating in the project and moving ahead with improvement of their with their health status and their health outcomes. So those are the primary metrics we're going to be looking at and focusing on a number of things within that. Let me hit the what's involved in the project, and these are some headlines that'll give you a picture of what we're actually doing. We have 11 buildings that are operated by three different housing providers. Cedars-Sinai Park has four of the buildings. Home Forward, formerly the Housing Authority of Portland, has four of the buildings, and then Reach Community Development has come in. 10 of the 11 buildings are in close proximity, mostly in downtown or near downtown Portland, so our ability to operate efficiently with respect to the population in the communities in those buildings is very high. We've got a total of 1,500 individuals, all seniors and people with disabilities, living in those buildings, and what we've done is we put together an integrated services delivery model that will involve health navigation, care coordination through a registered nurse, and then improved culturally specific service access to a wide range of services that are available in the community, and maximizing use of Medicaid services and Medicare services that individuals in the building are eligible for. We have a really strong resident advisory council that includes two representatives from each of the buildings. They've been involved from the very inception of the project. They've assisted with design of the services delivery system, design of the evaluation model, and they're raring to go with project implementation inside the buildings. So there's a lot more detail that could be presented, but that's probably sufficient for this morning. Pat?
Now, are they all in the Portland metro area?
Yes. Yes, they are all.
So, Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for having me. Thank you for having us here today. My name is Patrick Curran. I'm the CEO of CARE Oregon, and we're thrilled to be involved with this project. And before moving to the next slide, I want to keep on this slide, actually. CARE Oregon serves more than 225,000 Oregonians through four CCOs in the state of Oregon. We also serve about 11,000 Oregonians through our Medicare plan, which almost exclusively serves people who are low income with Medicare and Medicaid. What I want to say on this slide is when we talk about person-centered care, that gets thrown around a lot in terms of how we really do things different. And just the image of this slide, where the center of this is not an organization like ours, it's not a clinic, it's not the healthcare system, it's the images where people live. And the other organizations around it are trying to work together to figure out how to deliver services and coordinate care for individuals in terms of where they live. And rather than being the focus on a certain diagnosis or a certain treatment plan, what we're really addressing is things like social isolation and, as David said, the social determinants. So what this slide shows is all the different organizations that are involved. As you see, there's housing organizations, there's behavioral health, mental health, organizations that treat addictions, health plans such as ours, home health, skilled nursing, et cetera. And the key to forming this limited liability company, the reason we did it was two reasons, and David touched on these. We really wanted it to be replicable so that we could develop a model that could be applied to other communities. And the second is really the commitment by the participants. One of the issues when we were first forming, we had a lot of good dialogue about can't we just do this informally and in collaboration and contractually, but the key is that you've got participants that are committed, that are providing resources, both financial and people resources, to this in succeeding. So a little bit, an example of how we're involved in that is we have both a nurse and a social worker who are on the ground with the care model, with the care team working on the care model, looking at how we can better coordinate services for existing services, not providing new services, but provide coordination for existing services and really understanding the issues that people are facing in their home where they're facing it. So now David's going to talk about some of the funding sources.
Okay. Go ahead, Howard.
Again, Howard Klink. Howard Klink, Project Director. Let me click through to the next slide. Just so you have an idea of what the funding base for this project is, we've got Enterprise Community Partners, which has given us funding to fund significant parts of the project. Pat referred to the LLC, which is a limited liability company that has required, as participation in the project, equity share contributions. Cedars-Sinai has 51%. Care Oregon comes in as the next largest equity shareholder. Home Forward is third. And then the other participants that were listed on that partnership slide have smaller percentages of equity contribution. And the total dollar amount is represented on the slide. We've got a large grant and have gotten incredible support from the State Department of Human Services and Aging and Disability Services to focus with funding through the SIM grant that's funding both an evaluation and the program planning and development. Private foundation grants from Harry and Jeanette Weinberg Foundation and the Headco Foundation for a total of $1.3 million. Most of that money was raised in a nine-month period a little over a year ago. To support launch and planning for the project. So those are the funding trains that have kind of left the station and that are operating the planning activities that are going on, right, and evaluation activities.
So some of that money is being used for implementation, direct patient helping.
Yes.
Directly.
Yes. It's mostly setting up the administrative structure and bringing in services that are being funded by a variety of sources.
The federal money has been used to really help to provide that structure. The funds from the Weinberg and the Headco Foundations helped us to create a clinic space in which now PACE is co-located. We have a physician co-locating in there to be able to provide some urgent care and some individual health care. We have the Asian Health and Service Center stepping up and other organizations as well. So we're beginning to see that small clinic become an asset in terms of community-based health care.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
So I've been thinking a lot about different ways that companies function. One of the many things I've learned since I've become a legislator. Are you guys incorporated as a nonprofit or as a benefit company?
The LLC is not a nonprofit, but all of the members are required to either be nonprofit organizations or public housing organizations. So basically, it's in legal terms sort of a disregarded entity. It doesn't have quite honestly, I will be very impressed if it breaks even. But it's but functionally, the LLC model was a much simpler model to move towards. So that's why we went in that direction.
And it gets categorized as a single purpose LLC if you're following the way those things work. Mm-hmm.
God, I'm just thinking about reproducibility and ways to think about that. Thank you.
Sure. To that question, your question earlier, Madam Chair, about is it poor or appropriate, one of the foundation principles of the project is replication. All of our funding sources are interested, and equity partners are, some of them operate statewide, like Care Oregon and Reach Community Development are interested in, and the state in particular, are interested in replication. And part of the reason we chose this corporate structure was to make replication easier. And we now have a model and an LLC agreement that's actually public domain. So it should expedite. For the only last thing I would add to David's comment before we open it up for questions is he kind of gave you a brief summary of the latest developments. We've got primary care provider, the PACE program in there. We're adding services that are available in the community to use the clinic as a base for connecting and getting out into the buildings. And then finally, we're in discussions with other insurance payers and CCOs because they're all represented. Enrollees living in those buildings, we'd like to have participation from Family Care, Providence, Legacy, and other payers or CCOs that are involved in the buildings. So, David.
So what I'd like to emphasize prior to any questions is that this is a pilot project. Our goal is to see if we can put together a model for collaboration and coordination in a highly regulated world. So all of the HUD buildings, for example, are regulated by HUD, which means annual inspections of the buildings in terms of safety and security and a pretty strict structure. All of the providers are licensed in one way or another. But the question arises at some point if this becomes a model that is distributed around the state, how it will be regulated by the state. We look forward to the opportunity of, one, proving that we have a model that can be successful, and, two, working with the state on whatever the administrative rule structure needs to be to make it possible for this to be replicated. And as Howard mentioned, we're really treating the learning on this as public domain. None of us are looking at this project as an opportunity to make big money. What we're trying to do is apply private sector principles to good human services practice and to reduce the costs of care for people by providing them with the opportunity to stay home and receive care successfully in the community rather than to fall into institutions or repeated hospitalizations. So a few questions that have come up that I wanted to address. Resident choice, this is completely focused on person-centered care. Residents, it's an opt-in model. Residents will have a choice to participate or not. They will also have a choice of providers. We have a number of providers affiliated, but if they have another preferred provider, whatever it is, that's, we will work with whomever it is that will help the resident to stay in the community. Difference between housing with services model and assisted living. This is absolutely not assisted living. This is people living in the community in their own apartments. It's a radical difference. I happen to run a 161 bed assisted living facility, completely different set of regulations and a completely different structure, and there's just no way that the two overlap in any significant way. How will home care services be regulated when provided to housing with services participants? The home care service entity that's part of the LLC, Sinai Family Home Services, is licensed by the state. We will also work with any other licensed providers who need who may be available to the various residents in the buildings. So we basically are following the home care regulation. So those are a few of the frequently asked questions. We'd be glad to respond to any others that might occur to you.
Yes, Senator Shin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the question of the advisory board, can you talk a little bit more about the advocates who might be involved or not involved, or community-based organizations? I've heard the complaint that kind of community-based involvement hasn't been there on this project, and if you could address that, I'd appreciate that.
A couple things. So we set up the Resident Advisory Council very, very early on to get resident involvement from the get-go. I think some people may know that my background in developmental disabilities work has kind of defined my view of consumer-focused and resident involvement, and those are the principles we use. So we've got representatives from all the buildings. We met early on with all the agency participants, potential service providers. We've been meeting with them frequently. And then from an advocacy standpoint, we had early meetings with Oregon Legal Services, AARP, and several others to talk about ways they would be involved in participation in the project. A number of the early policies and procedures that we've developed for privacy protection and resident bills of rights have been made available to those organizations for input and comment. We've just got some more recent stuff developed by a HIPAA specialist law firm to help us with release of information and privacy protection. Those aren't finally developed enough to circulate yet, but they will be circulated to interested advocates and stakeholders when we get them. It's been our intention to bring AARP and some of the other advocacy entities into the Resident Advisory Council have an opportunity to engage with that group and certainly to include them in the planning process as we roll.
In addition, I might add, we've presented this project in front of the Senate Bill 21 Implementation Group and responded to questions and answers there. We met individually with SEIU to discuss the project during the earliest planning stages, and we continue to welcome the opportunity for discussion with the advocates.
Great model. We'd really like to see it be implemented statewide.
Madam Chair, can I ask one question? So obviously we all have constituents who not all of us, since it's Portland focus. I have constituents I think could benefit from this potentially. Could you email the criteria for enrollment to my office so that I can direct people in this direction. It's
or actually,
the time is appropriate.
Email it to Sandy, and then Sandy can get
it. We'll be very happy to do that. What I want to point out, Madam Chair, Senator Shields, the project currently is a pilot focused on the 11 buildings that we're talking about. We do hope that it will be replicated once we've been able to prove the effectiveness of the model, and that that various other housing organizations will be able to provide this kind of service. This is a model, incidentally, Senator Shields, that is built on lots of history. We built it around the model developed in Vermont by Cathedral Square, which is a statewide model there. We looked at Central City Concern, which has been a leader in housing with services for over 10 years. What we're doing is taking a model and taking it a step further, looking at elders. But we're very happy to be able to share any information we can with you.
We need to move on.
Thank you so much.
We have one. Thank you so much for coming. And hopefully most of you will be able to stay for our last presentation on race, ethnicity, language, and disability, their report, Tricia Tillman and Lydia Muniz.
Good morning, Chair Mona Sanderson and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to present today on REAL Plus D and House Bill 2134. My name is Tricia Tillman, and I'm the Director of the Office of Equity and Inclusion for the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here with Lydia Muniz, who's the Director of the Office for Equity and Multicultural Services in the Department of Human Services. So this is a shared presentation between our two departments. Okay, so just for a little bit of grounding, why are we interested in race, ethnicity, language, and disability data? As agencies, we have our own interests around focusing on the strengths and needs of the diverse clients and communities we serve. We want to ensure service equity and equitable outcomes through culturally and linguistically appropriate or culturally linguistically specific services. We want to make sure our workforce is appropriate and matches the diverse communities that we serve. We target quality improvement focused on achieving equity. Want to make sure our program and benefit design is relevant to the diverse communities that we serve, and we also want to meet federal funding requirements. This is not unique to Oregon. This is the way that our nation is moving in terms of a focus on the diversification of our clients. So how do we use race, ethnicity, and language data currently? The good news is we do use it. We don't just collect it. Particularly want to focus on Oregon Health Systems Transformation. The Health Policy Board has very much valued health equity, including reporting regularly on health equity data to identify needs and opportunities. So we have released two, as both DHS and OHA have released two reports on the state of equity looking at our agency outcomes as well as customer service surveys by race and ethnicity. And then also in our Oregon Health Systems Transformation, we are now providing our metrics data to the coordinated care organizations by race and ethnicity. We have a long way to go in order to provide data by language. We haven't reported that as much, as well as by disability status. That's a new area for us. So House Bill 2134 was introduced in 2013 by Representative Kenny Geyer and passed and signed into law. This was a result of advocacy by the Oregon Health Equity Alliance, the HOPE Coalition, under the leadership of APANO, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. The legislation, the law, now requires all programs of OHA and DHS that currently collect demographic data to report biennially to OHA on progress implementing the standards, which I'll talk a little bit more about challenges to full implementation of the standards and our plan for addressing those challenges. There wasn't a deadline for making our systems come into compliance with those standards, but we share that report biennially to you and to the legislature. So in terms of implementation of the law, we have convened a rules advisory committee, which established rules for REAL plus D, race, ethnicity, language plus disability data collection. So the standard has been established, which was step one of implementing the law. And then we completed and submitted a baseline assessment report to you in August, which basically looked at all of our data collection systems that collect any demographic information. And we compared the current state of our demographic data collection to the standard. And Lydia is going to provide a little bit more detail about that shortly. So in terms of the new standard for race, ethnicity, language, and disability data collection, some elements of that standard include combining race and ethnicity into one question. We've seen quite a bit of confusion about, you know, what is the difference? There's really no standard federal definition. The standard includes disability data collection, which is demographic data, not eligibility data. The standard expands options for race, ethnicity, disability, and language so that people can feel like they're being reflected in the data that we're collecting, and then we can understand outcomes and processes more from a granular perspective. The standard allows staff determinations when required. So sometimes if somebody doesn't want to answer a question about their demographics, staff are required to decide for somebody how they're going to be reflected in the data. But the standard now makes that explicit when that happens. And then the standard applies to both DHS and OHA programs, as well as any of our contractors. So it will apply to coordinated care organizations, local public health departments, addictions, mental health providers, and others. So I'm going to pass it over to Lydia.
Again, good morning. Thank you for having us here for the record again. My name is Lydia Muñiz with the Department of Human Services Office of Equity and Multicultural Services. And I will talk a little bit about the assessment findings. As Tricia talked about the State of Equity report, we knew from that report that programs across both agencies do collect data differently based on federal requirements, based on funding sources, and the capability of the systems that we each have in our agencies. And in June and July of this past summer, we conducted an assessment, again, on the data systems at both OHA and DHA to find out a baseline of where we are. The findings were captured in the report that was submitted to you in August. And briefly, I'll just touch upon some of the findings that we were able to report to you. So on the OHA side, among 55 OHA data sets that were looked at and that collect demographic information, what we found is that 87% of those data sets do collect the data already on race and ethnicity. However, a few of the data sets collected to the granularity that HB 2134 requires established. What it does is it has a much broader category that we are capturing right now. And again, on the OHA side, 24% of those data sets do currently ask for an open-ended race and ethnicity question. 65% of those do use client respondent, and Tricia referred to some of them under HB 2134 will allow the staff to make that identification if the respondent doesn't. But for now, 24% of the data sets on the OHA side do request an open-ended race ethnicity question. And of those data sets, again, that were utilized, 65% used the client-respondent identification of race and ethnicity, and as opposed to the staff identifying it. 65% allow multiple race responses, so if someone identifies with more than one, they are able to do that on the OHA side. 65% of those data sets do pick that up. And 45% collect some data on the client's language. And finally, 16% do collect it on disability. So I'm going to move over to the DHS side. On the DHS side, among the 14 DHS data sets that we collect demographic information on, 64% of those do collect information. Again, like OHA, they don't collect it at a granular level, but they do collect it as one of the, some of the broader race and ethnicity categories. We do collect 43% of the time we capture data on clients that choose the multiple race and ethnicity category. However, none of the data sets at DHS have that open-ended question about field for race and ethnicity. And we did find that 43% on the DHS side record the client race and ethnicity through the client's or the respondent's self-identification. And 57% of the time, or 57% of the data sets do collect data on the preferred language of the client or respondent on the DHS side. 10 of those systems, or 71%, collect the data on the client's or the respondent's disability, and 14% of those actually collect the data at the age in which the disabling condition began. So across the two agencies, we had some similarities and then also some very, very different ways of capturing the information. I think from that assessment, what we did discover, obviously, is that we need to standardize that because we do have it even across two agencies, some differences in how we collect that data. In order to be able to provide that information to our DHS and OHA leadership and key stakeholders, we need to have some standard. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the challenges that we identified through that assessment in meeting the HB 2134 requirements. And that includes that many of our systems are now outdated and they cannot sustain changes. We have different data requirements from our federal and funding sources. They're different across the national standards, are different across different programs. We have change management occurring across our two agencies. We also do have some staff discomfort, as well as some client or respondent discomfort in offering the level of information that HB 2134 would ask us to collect. And we do have, obviously, some necessary funding is needed for in order to continue to implement this project. Those are some of the challenges that our assessment revealed. And we'll move on to next steps. And to conclude, we will be working with the Office of Information Services to do a further assessment and to develop that business process and the business case that we will need in order to improve the data collection to the standards that we have established through HB 2134. They will also be working on a staged business plan for implementation. And of course, again, we will continue pursuing state and federal funding to help us with the implementation of this project. Thank you.
For those who are providing the data for you, has it been an undue hardship at all? Or is it for you just trying to get the data from the various processes that the entities have?
So, Madam Chair, on the DHS side, the answer would be yes. It was difficult to sort of even do an assessment of what all the data sets might be and then figuring out who the owners are. So it is a laborious process. But now that we have, I think, at least initiated this part of it, we were able to identify the individuals that we can go back to now and get further information.
So is this information really going to make a difference in what we can provide to these populations, or this is just to get the baseline of who the people are that we're serving?
Madam Chair, I would say it is going to make a difference. One of the ways that we've changed our process internally in the short term, even in advance of this legislation, was to start reporting out the difference in, for example, birth outcomes for Asians living in Oregon as compared to birth outcomes for Pacific Islanders living in Oregon. And what we found when we pulled those data apart was that there were disparities in birth outcomes for Pacific Islanders that had been previously hidden. Mm-hmm. We did not know. It had not been reported before. So by collecting more granular data, you know, some of the other hidden disparities that we've heard about from, for example, the Coalition for Communities of Color, is that there are disparities within the Asian Pacific Islander population. There are differences between the outcomes of Eastern Europeans who are now put in a bucket as white compared to white, you know, U.S. born counterparts. There are differences between African American and African immigrants. And right now, with our current data, we cannot pull those differences out. So I do think there will be improvements in service. One of the other challenges that we've identified is right now, race, ethnicity, language, disability data collection is often optional. And as Lydia mentioned, with that sense of staff discomfort, if they don't know why this is important and how it impacts service delivery, oftentimes for the sake of time, if they're on a productivity standard, they skip that question. So we do need to do a lot of work. And I think our next step includes doing more staff training and a deeper dive and more accountability around collecting that data.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you so very much. All right. I know my committee's gone, except for Chip. And so I do want to say that if you have any committee bills that you would like to be put pre-session filed, please get them to me and Sandy. And with that, we are adjourned. Thanks, Chip. We are adjourned.